Hands up.
Hello there, I'm Jay Bybee, and you may know me as one of Bush's lawyers that wrote the memos authorizing torture. But what you may not know is that right now, I'm a judge. That's right, a federal f***ing judge. So if you ever step before me in the Ninth Circuit Appellate Court, you better watch the f*** out, because who knows what I might do. Waterboard you, wrap a towel around your neck and slam your head into a wall, strip you naked, slap you, put you in a tiny box with bugs, and I'll do it because I'm crazy. I'm the Jack Bauer of judges, motherfucker, except I'm real, and you're paying my salary. Woo!
Reports out document an alarming rise in the number of hate groups in the United States. Found 926 active hate groups in the country. That's up more than 50%.
You have active intelligence that tells you people coming back from Iraq who might be mad at the military, who might simply have post-traumatic stress disorder, are being actively recruited by extremist groups?
Certainly. Our department is not the only department that has made that comment. The FBI has made the same comment. Returning veterans are targets of right-wing extremist groups that are trying to recruit those to commit violent acts within the country.
Check this out, man.
That was a look back at last week's news, and you're about to hear This Week in Radical History for the week starting April 20th.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for April 20th, 1887. Oscar Wilde would write on this date, "Every great man nowadays has disciples, and it's usually Judas who gets to write the biography." Also on April 20th, 1914, the Ludlow Massacre of striking miners and their families by the National Guard and Rockefeller's Company Police, burning a striking miners' camp, killing at least 5 men, 2 women, and 12 children. Next time you wonder how places like Rockefeller Center was made, you know on whose backs and blood it was paid with. Also on April 20th, 1916, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman on trial for presenting literature of birth control at the New Star Casino on April 8th. She defends herself but is convicted anyways. Refusing to pay the $100 blood money, she'll serve 15 days in jail instead. According to the New York Times, a similar reception to a Broadway play, Emma was applauded by several hundred supporters as she was led from the courthouse where police were posted to take her to jail. Also on this date, the Rascally Rabbit Rabbit. On April 20, 1979, President Jimmy Carter, while fishing, was attacked by a radical rabbit. Kid you not. A rabbit is filmed jumping into a lake, swimming at Carter's boat while fishing, and a Secret Service agent uses an oar to knock it back as the rabbit tries to jump into the boat. The report of the rabbit's last words being, quote, "down with all tyrants," could not be confirmed. Here's just a little more on that story.
When the incident occurred, a White House photographer luckily captured the incident in a now infamous photograph. The Washington Post ran it as a front page news article along with a cartoon called Paws. A spoof on the movie poster, Jaws, the Carter White House decided to issue a statement that the attack did occur, but it was not an ordinary rabbit, but rather a vicious Civilicus aquaticus, also known as a swamp rabbit. They added that it was hissing menacingly, its teeth flashing and nostrils flared, and making straight for the president.
There he is!
Where?
There.
What, behind the rabbit?
It is the rabbit.
You silly sod.
What?
He goes all worked up.
Well, that's no ordinary rabbit. Oh. That's the most foul, cruel, and bad-tempered rodent you ever set eyes on.
You tit. I saw my arm and I was so scared.
Look, that rabbit's got a vicious streak a mile wide. It's a killer.
What's he do? Nibble your bum?
He's got huge, sharp... He can leap about. Look at the bones.
Go on, boys. Chop his head off.
Right, silly little bitter. One rabbit, two coming right up.
Look. Jesus Christ. I warned you.
I've done it again.
I warned you, but did you listen to me? Oh, no, you knew it all, didn't you? Oh, it's just a harmless little bunny, isn't it?
Okay, sorry about that. I just couldn't resist. This week in Radical History for April 21st, 1967, I know this is hard to believe with all those good things Rockefeller did for the working man, but on this date, the governor, Nelson Rockefeller, signs anti-union Taylor Law, restricting public employees' right to strike with fines and jail time if they do. Also on April 21, 2001, FBI raids Seattle Indy Media Center. Security plans to protect Western leaders attending the trade summit in Quebec were stolen from a car over the weekend and posted hours later on the Seattle-based website. FBI agents seized computer logs, records, and staff and told them not to talk about the incident under threat of being held in contempt of court. The organization had violated no laws, but the breach of security is another embarrassment for the Canadian government. This is just one of many long lists of Indy Media Centers being raided by the man. This week in radical history for April 22nd, three well-known anarchists are prominent on this day. In 1873 in France, Luigi Lacini is born. He followed the idea of propaganda of the deed. He goes and kills the Empress Elizabeth of Austria. Also on April 22nd, 1891, Niccolò Sacco of Sacco Vassetti fame is born in Italy. Italian-American anarchists Sacco and Vassetti were put to death for the murder-robbery charge that was dubious at best. Riots and protests would occur throughout the United States and the world. Also on April 22nd, 1897, also an Italian anarchist, Pietro Accorito, age 26, attempts to stab the King of Italy and will get life imprisonment for the attempt. Two more items for April 22nd, 1899. Early feminist novel, The Awakening by Kate Choplin, is published. Last on this date in 1996, nonviolent activists cut down three poles supporting the U.S. nuclear submarine radio trigger at Clam Lake, Wisconsin. The antenna collapsed and left the Navy unable to launch a first strike for several days. This will be just one of many actions against the Navy nuke submarine communication installation in northern Wisconsin. This week in radical history for April 23rd. People, the
this is your radio reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 23rd in 1635, the Boston Latin School opened in Boston, Massachusetts, becoming the very first public school in America. The school was originally founded to educate the sons of wealthy New England families. Since then, public education has evolved into a huge institution, unfortunately filled with inequalities. And it doesn't take a magnifying glass to see that public schools in working-class neighborhoods and communities of color are severely lacking in budget dollars and resources. Would I be wrong to say that America's public education system is actually designed to maintain the status quo? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on April 23rd, 1904, Flathead Indian Reservation in northwestern Montana splits into allotments. Nearly half the land is then, surprisingly, given to white settlers. Also on April 23, 1968, beginning the occupation of anti-war sit-in at Columbia University. Columbia University students seize administration building, hold dean hostage. Police storm campus 8 days from now, resulting in numerous casualties and 700-plus arrests as the strike continues for another month. 6 weeks prior to the Columbian strike, a petition bearing nearly 2,000 signatures calling on Columbia to cease classify war research was brought to the president's office. The university response, placing the students who presented it on disciplinary probation, so the strike began. Also on this date in 1993, the death of Cesar Chavez, nonviolent civil rights activist and founder of the United Farm Workers. Here's a short 25-second PSA in his own words.
We cannot defend and be kind to animals until we stop exploiting them in the name of sport, in the name of science, in the name of fashion, and yes, exploiting animals in the name of food. The basis for peace is respecting all creatures. That's the basis for peace.
This week in radical history for April 24th, 1923. About a month ago, the Bulgarian army opens fire on a peaceful demonstration in Yambol, Bulgaria, during an anarchist protest against the government's decision to disarm the people. The army shoots into a crowd and massacre occurs. On this date, April 24th, 1923, in Slivin, the anarchist Nikolai Dragnev and his two brothers are shot by the army under pretext of escape attempt. Nikolai Dragnev was one of the significant figures in Bulgarian anarchism. Propagandist and esteemed popular speaker, he is not part of the uprising on the March 26 protest and failed to hide after the repressions began. This would cost him his life.
This is your radio reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 24th in 1954, political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal was born. Mumia was a member of the Black Panther Party, a supporter of the Radical Move community, and active in the Association of Black Journalists. In 1982, he was convicted of shooting a police officer and sentenced to death in what his supporters labeled an outrageously unfair trial. Despite many appeals and an abundance of evidence supporting his innocence, he remains on death row. While in prison, Mumia Abu-Jamal continues his amazing work as a journalist, passionately exposing injustices and speaking out against police brutality and the prison industrial complex. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Mark Charles Parker, an African American, was accused of raping a white woman. When he was arrested, the Mississippi State Trooper offered the woman's husband a pistol to shoot Parker. 3 days before Parker was to stand trial, he is dragged from his cell, beaten and shot on this date in 1959. His body was found in the Pearl River 10 days later. The FBI investigated and even obtained confessions from some of the 8 white suspects. However, the county prosecutor refused to present the evidence, and the state grand jury and federal grand jury refused to indict. Also on April 24, 1964, crosses burned in 64 of Mississippi's 82 counties to prepare for the Freedom Summer. Freedom Summer was an event organized to get blacks registered to vote, and the KKK would come out in force to try to stop it. Lastly, on this date, in 1989 in China, tens of thousands of students strike in Beijing. On the 27th, 50,000 students march to Tiananmen Square in defiance of authorities. A prelude to the anti-government protests in Tiananmen Square, where up to 1 million gather in May. A few years later, the U.S. had normalized relationships with China, but 20 years later, and after 40 years of sanctions, the U.S. will not normalize relationships with Cuba. Go figure.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 25th in 1805, the Lewis and Clark expedition reached the junction of the Missouri and the Yellowstone River in what is now North Dakota. They had set out about a year earlier to evaluate the land and explore the Missouri River in search of a trade route to the Pacific Ocean. Early on in their journey, Lewis and Clark were joined by a white translator and his Shoshone wife, Sacagawea, who was sold to him at a young age. Sacagawea played a crucial role in the expedition. Unfortunately, there are many romanticized fabrications about Sacagawea's life, and her contributions are often manipulated to represent Indian compliance with colonialism. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on April 25th, 1908, journalist Edward R. Morales is born. Here's an actor quoting his words.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to associate, to speak, and to defend the causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the results. We proclaim ourselves, indeed as we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world, but we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad, and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
Also on April 25th in 1996 in Australia, Anzac Day. Swastikas are painted on the front door of anarchist Barricade Bookstore. A local demonstration against fascist organizations is held in a march to the bookstore. Anzac Day is kind of Australian New Zealand's Liberation Day, when the fighting men of World War I, tired of British rule over them and using them as pawns during the war, gained their independence from that colonial power. This week in Radical History for April 26, 1649 in England. Robert Lockyer is sentenced to be shot for a fermenting revolt in the New Model Army, and the first Digger Manifesto is published, The True Levelers, Standard Advanced. Quote, for by their labors the poor have lifted up the tyrants and tyranny, and by denying them labor for hire, it shall pull them down again. He that works for another, either for wages or to pay him rent, works unrighteously and still lifts up the curse.
Club is all their law. Stand up now, stand up now. The club is all their law. Stand up now. The club is all their law to keep all men in awe that they no vision saw to maintain such a law. Stand up now, diggers all, stand up now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning, our entire broadcast features Middle East scholar and analyst Mui Rabbani. Rabbani, of Palestinian heritage, was born in the Netherlands and educated at Tufts University. Rabbani is currently a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, a co-author of Jadilia, and a contributing editor to the Middle East Report. This Week in Palestine recorded Mui Rabbani at an informal discussion at his alma mater, Tufts University. He speaks about the current situation in both Syria and Palestine, and then takes questions. Here is Mui Rabbani at Tufts University.
I've been asked to speak about Syria and Palestine in the context of the regional upheaval in the Middle East. And to begin perhaps with a few general comments in terms of the upheaval that the region is undergoing, I think there's several broad themes that we see either being intensified or reversed, ironically enough, now in Syria. And those are trends that I would identify as fragmentation, disintegration, state collapse, and the growing prominence of non-state actors filling in those gaps. So perhaps I'll start with Syria because it helps kind of contradict everything that I've just said. What we've been seeing in Syria, I think, is a gradual reversal of those trends, particularly since late September with the beginning of the Russian military intervention in Syria. I think Syria's great misfortune this past half decade is that the conflict in Syria has been more or less about everything but Syria and the Syrian people and the rights and future of the Syrian people. It has rather become an arena for every conceivable regional agenda and proxy conflict. And when I say proxy conflict, I don't mean just the usual ones, such as the United States versus Russia or Iran versus Saudi Arabia, but it's become the arena even for proxy conflicts between, for example, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, between Turkey and Egypt. So to the extent that even people or actors who are nominally on the same side of the equation are often more preoccupied with their own petty, if you will, internal rivalries than they are with their struggle and conflict against their, let's call them their more formal adversaries and enemies. What and this had resulted in a kind of prolonged stalemate in Syria for a period of several years until last summer, with perhaps the death of the former Saudi King Abdullah, for whom reducing the power and influence, regional power and influence of the Muslim Brotherhood was a key policy objective, being replaced by the current king, Salman, for whom, in the context of the Iranian nuclear agreement, mobilizing what was perceived by him, I believe, as a united Sunni front, if you will, against Tehran took precedence. This led to a reconciliation of sorts between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, the formation of Jaish al-Fat, the Army of Conquest, comprising several of the key Syrian rebel groups in northern Syria. And what we saw in the late summer and the late spring and summer of last year was this sudden, in some ways dramatic, advance by the Syrian rebels in northwest Syria, and primarily in Idlib province, which they managed to control almost fully, and beginning to threaten the coastal regions of Latakia, and then also advancing somewhat in the eastern Damascus countryside. The key moment, I think, was when President Bashar al-Assad, an autocrat who is not given to displaying weakness in any way, shape, or form, gave an address to the Syrian people, which in itself was unusual, on the 26th of July 2015, and was quite open about the manpower difficulties that the Syrian army was facing, and indicated that the Syrian army may pull back from certain areas of the country in order to maintain its control of key strategic regions. And I think it's against this backdrop that the Russian intervention in Syria should be understood and assessed. And what I would say about the Russian intervention is that, seen from the perspective of Moscow, perhaps a little less so if seen from the perspective of Damascus or Tehran, but certainly from Moscow's perspective, it's been a signal success that has managed to comprehensively transform not only the dynamics of the Syria conflict, but also the political framework within which it is being addressed. And if we look at what Russia has and has not achieved, I think it's fair to say that this quite closely reflects what they were trying to achieve and were not trying to achieve. First and foremost was to stem the further loss of territory to the Syrian rebels, and that can go down as a clear success. Secondly, to consolidate those areas that were already under the control of the Syrian regime, and where possible, to expand them. Now, those of you who have been following this may remember that when the Sukhois first took to Syrian airspace, we were treated to a lot of commentary about how this is turning into a second Afghanistan. B, they're bombing everyone but the Islamic State and the Nusra Front. And C, they've only managed to take 3 or 4 square kilometers in the first month of operation. So this is obviously going nowhere. Well, what we saw in the late fall and winter of this of last year was that these constant, very intense aerial attacks on the Syrian opposition clearly were having a cumulative effect, because all of a sudden we started seeing big gains by Syrian government forces, particularly in Aleppo province, efforts to seal off the Syrian-Turkish border, which I think also became one of Putin's pet projects after the Turkish Air Force downed the Syrian jet, and basically the, sorry, the Russian fighter. And it was a situation in which the Syrian government was once again very much in the saddle. And that, ironically, is where the problems potentially began, because I think the Russians had a very clear understanding that there is no military solution to the Syria conflict. And their strategy is one of seeking to separate those elements of the armed Syrian opposition that are prepared for reconciliation with the Syrian government in one form or another, together with similar elements of the civilian opposition to the Syrian government, to separate those from the hardcore that will not accept any agenda that does not prioritize regime change from Damascus. And it's in this context that we began to see the Vienna process, United Nations Security Council Resolution 2254, and now this new negotiations show in Geneva. And what I think the Russians have successfully achieved is that they have taken regime change off the table. No one is anymore speaking about the departure of President Assad as an integral component of the implementation of the political process. And they have effectively, if not formally, but at least effectively, replaced the process which was supposed to lead further to the Annan plan, to the so-called transitional governing body with full executive powers, transformed it from that into what is now being described as a national unity government. In other words, rather than replacing the powers that be in Damascus, the current plan is to expand it in order to bring in those elements of the Syrian opposition that I was referring to earlier. But this is also, I think, where we're beginning to see fissures between Moscow on the one hand and Damascus on the other. And I would argue that Tehran, which is perhaps a more important partner for Syria than Russia is, probably leans towards Damascus's view. From the perspective of a family dictatorship that has ruled its country without challenge for going on four decades now, any political process is a losing proposition. Any opening is a sign of weakness that will be interpreted in Damascus as the beginning of the end. And it was in this context that we saw statements by President Assad that, in fact, what they intend to do is to reconquer every last square inch of Syrian territory and reestablish Syrian sovereignty and all the rest of it, which I think represents a clear difference of perspective between Moscow and Damascus. And this is a debate or a contradiction that I think will continue to play out in the months ahead. The issue here, of course, is that Moscow does not have very much leverage to impose its own views, because at the end of the day, they have no viable alternative to President Assad. They can, of course, reduce the level of their military support. I wouldn't really call their most recent decision a military withdrawal from Syria, but it seems to be saying to the Syrians, okay, from this point on, if you want to retake Palmyra from the Islamic State movement, we're with you. If you want to march on Raqqa and get there, and Deir ez-Zor and get there before the Americans do, we're definitely with you. But when it comes to reconquering Aleppo, you're on your own, unless you can get your Iranian and other allies to do it. And so I think we are beginning to see differences between the Russian conception of how the Syria conflict should be resolved on the one hand, and let me call it the Syrian-Iranian one on the other. Where does the United States stand in all this, just by way of my concluding comments on Syria? I think the hallmark of the Obama administration's approach to Syria has been part and parcel of its Middle East policy, which is that come what may, no new Middle East war under Obama's watch. And although I think the Obama administration has clear preferences about what they would like to see happen in Syria, they have watched, I think, with more satisfaction than is generally accepted, that the Russians have been prepared to invest the resources and efforts to achieve Moscow's policy objectives in a way that Washington is simply not prepared to even contemplate. And if the previous American attitude towards Syria was, well, good luck, Moscow, and we hope it turns into another Afghanistan for you, I think they now realize the Russian approach is more in common with Chechnya than Afghanistan. And given America's own threat perception about Syria, my sense is that the Americans would not consider it catastrophic if the Russians actually succeeded in stabilizing Syria, which brings in another factor, which is that of America's regional allies, the Saudis first and foremost, but also the Turks, Qataris, and others. And here I'll just make a concluding point, since I've already made a concluding point. But I'll put more.
You're definitely. Feel free.
Thank you. Which is that we often tend to look at Syria in Cold War terms. Which is Cold War terms, which is to say you have the great powers, the superpowers, the Russians and the Americans, and then you have their proxies, the Saudis, the Iranians, the Turks. Well, things have changed a bit since 1990, which is to say that the superpowers, if I can use that term loosely, no longer have the same level of influence and control over the regional parties that was typically the case in the Cold War. If you go back to the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, you often had these third world conflicts where the regional or the local parties were not that far apart, but were for a variety of reasons prevented from reaching agreement by Washington and Moscow, who wanted to continue fighting to the last African, to the last Asian, to the last Latin American. That's no longer the case. And the mere fact of what appears to be American-Russian consensus on Syria is, to my mind, absolutely no guarantee that the regional parties are going to fall into line and fully cooperate with whatever Kerry and Lavrov decide. So the diplomatic process in Geneva is very fragile. I wouldn't put too much store in it. And I think that there are parties in the region just waiting for the first sign of collapse so that they can resume an expanded military intervention, for example, providing more and better weapons to the Syrian rebels, sending more militia forces to support regime forces, and so on. Turning to Palestine, well, there you do very much see these regional trends of fragmentation and disintegration. And you see it, of course, on multiple levels, not only within the Palestinian political system and in the context of the abiding schism between Fatah and Hamas, but also within each of these camps. Fatah has been reduced to a political movement in name only. The PLO has been reduced to three letters that no longer mean very much. Hamas has been very rapid to internalize and copy, if you will, the experience of Fatah. What took Fatah decades to achieve, Hamas has managed to achieve in a few short years, so that now, for example, the tensions between the internal and the exile leadership, between the military wing and the civilian leadership and so on, is reaching, I think, a stage of almost open warfare. I mean, to give you one example, in 2006, I was in Gaza and I interviewed a member of, a just elected member of the Palestinian Legislative Council for Hamas, and it was practically public knowledge that this individual had been strongly opposed to the decision by Hamas to participate in the 2006 elections. Yet when talking to him, he spoke with such passion that you would think that it was only because of him that Hamas decided to participate in those elections, and that he somehow single-handedly managed to convince the rest of the movement. That would never happen today. This idea of party discipline, if you will, no longer exists, and there has been fairly open warfare within the movement between, let's say, the wing represented by Mahmoud Zahar in Gaza versus that represented by Khaled Mash'al now in Doha, and so on. And so that also, I think, has its ramifications on the reconciliation process. There are currently talks taking place in Doha between Fatah and Hamas, but basically between people who either do not have the power to make any agreements succeed, and or people who are reporting to powers that want to ensure no agreement is properly implemented. Because at the end of the day, there are the schism is getting more institutionalized by the day, with vested interests determined to see its perpetuation getting more powerful. And perhaps most importantly, a Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas, who on the one hand is still convinced that if he can only hold out for a few more months, Hamas rule in the Gaza Strip is going to collapse, and even if it doesn't, the price that he and his authority will be made to pay for embarking on reconciliation is going to be significantly higher in terms of regional and international support than the price of perpetuating the schism. And it is in this context that we've seen the growing unrest that began last fall, September, October. The problem here is that if you look at who are primarily involved in these incidents, this is not the mass demonstrations being organized by a unified national command representing the main political factions that you had in the first Intifada. These are not armed militias being spawned by Fatah and Hamas and the Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front and so on that you had in the second Intifada. These are 13, 15, 17-year-old kids acting perhaps above all impulsively, certainly without any political direction, and I would say more significantly, without any political affiliation. And this is, I think, the real danger that the Palestinian political system is facing. Palestinians have always been a highly politicized people, in the sense that if you would look at public opinion polls in the 70s and the 80s, over 90% of people would express an affiliation at the time with Fatah or the Popular Front or the Communist Party or whatever. You look now, our biggest movement has become none of the above, and it continues to grow. And this represents a crisis of the Palestinian national movement that has, I think, no easy answers, because in my view, the precondition for addressing and resolving this crisis is Palestinian reconciliation that would see the integration of Hamas and Islamic Jihad into the Palestine Liberation Organization on the basis of national strategic consensus on a political program. Unfortunately, the prospects for that happening are simply receding, leading to a situation where I think it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that the Palestinian people are being transformed, perhaps have been transformed, from a coherent political force into a demographic reality without much political consequence. Yes, you have a Palestinian community in Gaza and the West Bank, within Israel and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, But politically, what does this mean? Unfortunately, increasingly little. And it's in this context that you have a leadership that not only has no leverage over either Israel or the United States or even within the region, but is not seeking leverage, which almost perceives leverage as somehow a form of bad manners. And you have the most recent statement by the American administration that they will not be conducting any new diplomatic initiatives for the rest of the term. Those of you who, like me, continue to be aghast that the Oslo Accords were ever signed may think that is a good thing, but it's nevertheless a gift to the Israelis. It's exactly where Netanyahu wants the Americans to be, so that he can have his way unencumbered with the occupied territory. So the short-term future, at least, I would say, is extremely bleak, because while we may continue to see more unrest in the occupied territories, it is not connected, not only not connected to any political project, but increasingly disconnected even from any of the existing political forces. If I can conclude on a note of optimism, the only thing I would say is if we look at the antecedents, those of you who remember the genesis of the First Intifada in 1987, it came in the context of a decade in which, in the early 1980s, the PLO was expelled from its last frontline bastion, if you will, in Beirut, at a time when the Arab states were increasingly diverted towards the Iran-Iraq war. And it came within weeks of the 1987 Arab League summit in Amman, where for the first time, I believe, in the Arab League's history, Palestine was not even on the agenda or in the final communique. And by the end of that year, the youth of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip had managed to seize headlines in places where they had never managed to impose themselves before. Of course, the problem is that came on the basis of intensive organizing by the main Palestinian factions. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but it is something I think that people are increasingly aware of. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. And now we definitely have time for questions and answers. For questions.
Please.
So is the organizing going on in villages like Bihlim and Nabi Saleh and so on just a dead end in your view, or could that somehow be an example that will be taken up?
I would say it's neither a dead end nor an example. It's not a dead end in the sense that you have had these absolutely dedicated and committed people just going out week after week after week for years now, same time, same place, demonstrating against the same wall and the same occupation with no let up, and letting nothing stop them, but are doing so in isolation, because if you recall when these groups first started demonstrating against the wall, the factions would participate, Israeli peace groups would join them. That, to the best of my understanding, is either no longer the case or increasingly rarely the case. And I would even argue that the Palestinian leadership, at least in Ramallah, sees that maybe threat is too strong a word, but doesn't want these people to form a template. Because when they do, then you get things like the teacher strike that you've had in the West Bank in the past few weeks. So it's not something that has been embraced and adopted and co-opted and expanded by the leadership. The leadership is quite happy for these people to demonstrate because it can make good propaganda use of them, but it prefers that they stay in their little village and near the Green Line.
Hi, thank you for the analysis. My name is Wissam. I'm from Palestine and I'm a visiting scholar at MIT. I'm just wondering whether you see any opportunity for the Palestinian reconciliation in the near future based on your experience on the local politics?
Probably not. When it comes to Palestinian reconciliation, I tend to defer to Hani al-Masri, who I strongly encourage you to follow his columns, which are usually published every week in an Ayyam, if you have access. And he just, I mean, his latest article, which I was just reading yesterday, was pointing out why increasingly reconciliation is also no longer an option for Hamas. I mean, we've known all along that you have a Fatah leadership, or rather a Palestinian Authority leadership, that is simply not interested in reconciliation. To the extent that with the Beach Camp Accord of 2014, Hamas basically capitulated to Fatah. It gave Fatah, or it gave Abu Mazen everything he wanted, and he refused to accept their surrender. That's why the agreement was never, because of this idea that, you know, if they just stew in their own juice of financial crisis and so on for a few more weeks, a few more months, maybe a year, it will collapse. Well, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. On the positive side, there's a growing feeling within Fatah, let's say at the second level down, that Fatah cannot save itself except in some kind of partnership with Hamas. But these are people who I don't see having the power and influence to force reconciliation down Abbas's throat. My view is that's something that remains within the power of the Palestinians to influence. I mean, if you take I can't remember the name of it, the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip in 2012, Pillar of Cloud or Pillar of White Phosphorus, I still remember. You know, this was at a time that there had, Mubarak had just been overthrown. You had a government in Cairo that was sympathetic, not so much to the Palestinians, but specifically to Hamas. And it was still in this environment where, you know, let's say the Arab Spring phase of the upheaval. Arab leaders and foreign ministers were beating a path to be the first in the Gaza Strip, even while Israeli bombs were still raining down on Gaza. They all wanted to get there before Erdogan. You know, so, and people who had been very hostile to Hamas specifically, all of a sudden want to have their pictures taken with Ismail Haniyeh. And so that demonstrates to me that Palestinians do have it within their power to put themselves, certainly on the regional agenda, but to do that they need to get their act together. And so in response to your question, I would say that, for me, reconciliation remains a first, second, and third priority, because without a national movement, without a national agenda, it's going to be very difficult to think of achieving any of these other things that you've mentioned.
Thank you very much for your talk. My name is Ali Yassir. My question is on Syria. You mentioned the lack of influence of the powers on different parties participating in the conflict, and you mentioned Jaish al-Fatah. So I was wondering, what role would groups like Ahrar al-Sham, Salafist groups like Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al-Islam, play in any transition, or now are they playing any role in the political process? And as a second question, what is the current state of, is there any discussion in Palestine and Israel on what's going on in Syria?
Well, in response to your first question, I think this is again one of those areas where you can see a developing gap between Moscow and Damascus. They have this whole discussion over listing terrorist organizations, and I believe it was the Americans, and certainly the Saudis and other regional powers, wanted to have it limited exclusively to Islamic State and Nusra Front, and others wanted to have it expanded to basically even people who were guilty of thought crimes against the Assad regime. But My understanding is that Moscow, for example, has not insisted on having Harar al-Sham placed on the terrorist list, because what they're doing now with the cessation of hostilities is basically giving these people a pause for thought. Here's your opportunity. Do you now want to become part of the regime, to put it very crudely, or do you want to continue fighting on and be treated as indistinguishable from Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra? Whereas for Damascus, you know, the agenda remains military victory and unconditional surrender of the opposition and so on. So, but the issue here is that while many of these parties seem at least prepared to entertain the prospect of serious negotiations, even if on a very different basis than Damascus is, I think there is also countervailing pressure coming on them from their regional sponsors to walk away at the first sign of failure and resume the armed struggle, if you will. In terms of how Palestinians are looking at it, it's been a very interesting dynamic. As you know, Hamas had its headquarters in Damascus until 2012, and Fatah has been at loggerheads with Damascus since the mid-1960s. What's happened now is that Hamas has withdrawn from Damascus on the basis of, regardless of the political or moral judgments one might make, it's been a severe miscalculation, in the sense that I think after Morsi's election, the Hamas leadership came to the conclusion that the Muslim Brotherhood was going to reign supreme in the Middle East for the next several hundred years, and took the premature step of breaking with Damascus, moving to Doha, hoping that it would at least lead to reconciliation with the Saudis, and hopefully some kind of renewed relations with either the EU or key European states as well. None of that happened. The only thing they have to show for their troubles is an increasingly difficult and bitter relationship with Iran, which has been shifting its patronage to other Palestinian movements. Well, now you talk to Fatah activists, or many of them at least, the way they talk about the Syrian government, you would have think, in fact, they've been allies since the mid-1960s, and let bygones be bygones. So there's been quite a bit of a change in those perspectives. But to me, the real tragic aspect of the attitude of Palestinian leaderships to Syria has been their attitude towards the Palestinian community in Syria, which is facing unprecedented difficulties, not being citizens of Syria. They don't have the option for refuge in neighboring states that Syrians do. And the way the Palestinian leaders talk about them, it's almost, you know, like spectators at a football match. There are very few signs that indicate these are their own people, let alone that they're responsible.
Yeah, I have a question about the Palestinian political movements and the streets, or the kind of chaos or loss that they are in now. I'm thinking about the factors that led to that. So when I look at between 2000 and 2003 or 2004, really Israel managed to clean the Palestinian streets from active leaderships through assassinations, send them to the exile, or sentence them life sentence in the prison. And at that time, they left the street to the Palestinian Authority, which they have done nothing to help, especially the new generation. I wonder if these are some of the factors, or if you can say more about the factors that led to where the Palestinian...
Those are factors, but I would look primarily to the Oslo Agreement as the main factor. There were two main aspects that were implicit in Oslo, I would say maybe even explicit. First of all, is the institutional fragmentation of the Palestinian people between those in the occupied territories on the one hand and those everywhere else on the other. We're not talking about the United States or Germany here. We're talking about a people, more than half of whom do not reside in the territories of the authority. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the PLO had been an exile movement until 93, with most of its leadership, its structures, and so on in exile. Overnight, those were deleted. You basically marginalized the core, what had been one core of your constituency. Second of all, Oslo, implicit in Oslo, was a demobilization of Palestinian political activism. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that was never fully implemented because Arafat's attitude towards Oslo was very transactional. You know, if it works, I'm with it. If it doesn't, I have alternatives. And this became clear in 2002 when he, at the very least, allowed for, if not encouraged, the remobilization of the Palestinians. But after his demise and the succession of Abu Mazen, demobilization was the one consistent policy that he's had. So I would look more towards these longer-term structural factors rather than the Israeli actions, because what the Israelis have been doing, they've been doing for decades. Mm-hmm. Why is it succeeding now? It doesn't seem like they've gotten more effective all of a sudden.
That's true.
So that's just a follow-up. Does that mean that generational change is not a factor?
I think the significance of generational change is exaggerated. I don't think it's as important a factor as... I mean, this whole... there's, you know, this whole theory of old guard, young guard, and that what you have is a series, an anachronistic generation that returned from Tunis and had tired of the struggle and was no longer prepared to participate, versus a up-and-coming... new and activist generation based in the occupied territories. I think that points to a dichotomy that doesn't really exist in reality. And if you look at the Second Intifada, many of the key leaders were actually returnees from the older generation, from exile. And if you look at the current situation, many of those who have been most involved in and committed to, for example, security coordination with Israel, and the intensification of the demobilization are actually from the younger generation based in the occupied territory. So I don't think it's a very applicable paradigm.
I kind of have a follow-up. Looks like there's a bunch.
Yeah, a lot of questions.
Yeah. Well, I will, maybe because it is kind of a follow-up.
Okay.
I will jump in, which is to ask about, you did end on the high note, and I... And I wonder, in some senses, you know, given this conversation, what does that high note mean, right? Because if the village-based and other very local kinds of organizing are, you know, really kind of being derailed in at least a passive way by the PA, right, because they could lead to popular mobilization, like in the teacher strike, then, you know, where is the high note really leaving us with, right? Given the fragmentation, given the lack of reconciliation that you're also arguing is key for real political change. I mean, do we need to think about new kinds of mobilization that would have to happen on completely different terms? And then I'll just throw in a question of, you know, do you think, where do you think this might actually happen? Do you think 48 Palestinians have an increasing, you know, prominent role to play? Or because of the lack of broader political institutions among Palestinians, is that not an option?
I think it's a very difficult question to answer because... On the one hand, the premise of your question is that because the situation is so focused within the occupied territories, shouldn't that mean that new ideas, new initiatives, and so on come from outside that very tightly controlled box? And on the face of it, there is every reason to agree with that presumption. But you can also look at it from a different perspective, which is saying precisely because Palestinian political life has been reduced not even to the occupied territories, but specifically to the West Bank, excluding East Jerusalem, that is the only place from which meaningful change can emerge, because if it happens in Nazareth or in Khan Yunis or in Beirut, it's going to be extremely difficult to translate any such initiatives into change in a system that is not only based in Ramallah, but very insulated from any external pressures. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of two minds mm-hmm. about it. I've hedged my bets.
Yeah, sounds good.
We keep hearing about the imminent collapse of the Palestinian Authority, or at least the possibility. And in fact, the imminent collapse has been hearing it for some time. What's your take on that, and what does that mean for what does that look like? And immediately, what does that mean for the Palestinian people in terms of money coming in and the fact that the Palestinian Authority is the major player in the Palestinian economy? And just what does that mean?
I don't know, because I've never really taken those predictions seriously. If you look at the sheer volume of interests that are vested in the indefinite perpetuation of the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian interests, Israeli interests, regional interests, quote-unquote donor interests, I find it extremely difficult to think of circumstances in which this entity will be permitted to collapse or disintegrate. I mean, at the height of the Second Intifada, you had the Bush administration in Washington, you still had Yasser Arafat in charge of the Palestinians being denounced as illegitimate morning, afternoon, and night. You had the security forces indisputably involved in the armed intifada and all the rest of it. There was never any talk of... And even when the Israelis started withholding all the tax receipts and so on, you know, it was Brussels to the rescue. So I find it very difficult to conceive of circumstances in which Palestinian Authority collapses. I suppose there's always a possibility of unintended consequences. For example, the Palestinians restrict or terminate security coordination, and then Israel takes retaliatory measures, and Brussels is too late to come to the rescue. Or I guess it could happen. What I would be more concerned about is a post-Abbas scenario where Israel is able to use its influence to further fragment even the West Bank administration, so that you get kind of a warlord in Nablus, a warlord in Ramallah, a warlord in Hebron, and so on, and be able to further fragment the system.
You have been listening to Middle East scholar Mui Rabbani speaking at Tufts University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse.
So the common narrative around the war on obesity goes something like this. Due to a massive epidemic of laziness and lack of control, people in the U.S. are becoming fatter. As a result of this, they are contracting serious diseases, draining the healthcare resources of the country, and tearing down the moral fabric of our society. The reality is much more complicated. In the medical community and in the media, obesity is typically described as an epidemic,
Mm-hmm. So the same terminology that's used for the H1N1 virus or cholera. As Amy Farrell put it in her book, Fat Shame, with its connotations of disease, contagion, and proliferation, the choice of the term epidemic is deliberately alarmist, suggesting imminent danger and sure catastrophe if not addressed. Mm-hmm. Just last week, the American Medical Association decided to take this one step further and classify obesity as a disease.
We have an epidemic of obese six-month-olds. There's something wrong with our biochemical negative feedback system that normally controls energy balance.
Many of the leading obesity researchers who have created the official standards for what constitutes overweight and obese have also received sizable funding from the pharmaceutical and weight loss industries.
You're listening to episode 737 of Unwelcome Guests, The War on Obesity. I'm Robin Upton. We have two speakers for you this time. We're going to begin with Rebecca Anshel Song speaking at Socialism 2013, 40 minutes on sexism and the food and diet industry. And thank you to We Are Many for delivering this via their website, wearemany.org.
Whether the other women in their line of eyesight are skinnier or heavier than they are, whether or not they've exercised enough, whether or not other people find them repulsive, and the list goes on and on. A Glamour magazine survey not too long ago found that 97% of women, so basically all women, have an I hate my body moment every day, and the average was that they have these thoughts once every waking hour. As an example of how this obsession works, I want to read a quote from an eating disorder recovery forum. This woman said, "I can't remember a time when my whole life didn't revolve around my weight. My mood is based on what my scale says every morning. I decide what I'll eat today depending on that scale. I pull it out several times a day to see what it says, several times a day getting undressed, and then criticizing myself for weighing too much. I don't think I'll ever be happy." Now, obviously not every woman has this exact relationship with a scale, but it's clear that most women feel enormous pressure to look a certain way, to look differently than they do, specifically to be a particular weight, and this causes an enormous amount of anxiety and unhappiness. So what I'm hoping to do today is explore why these very broad and deep-seated problems exist among so many women, what is actually behind the horrible way we view our bodies. And I also want to challenge some of the typical assumptions that are often made about dieting and body weight. And then finally, I'll talk a little bit about what it would take to actually build an alternative to this, where people would have access to healthy food and healthcare, and where women would not be psychologically damaged with regard to their bodies. Where is this obsession with women's bodies coming from? I'm sure most of us in this room are conscious of the way that women's bodies and sexuality are used to sell everything, from hamburgers to deodorant. Really, women's bodies are used not only to sell products, but to sell a particular image of what women should look like. And young women grow up with a nearly constant assault of images reflecting this particular body ideal. And these images of bodies, by the way, are increasingly thin. So the average model today weighs 23% less than the average woman and is between a size 0 and 4. In fact, the majority of runway models actually meet the weight criteria to be considered anorexic. Sizes 6 to 14 are now modeled by plus-size models in the fashion industry. And even mannequins are dramatically undersized. So if the average mannequin were brought to life, it would be so thin that it would not be able to menstruate. And those model sizes, by the way, are pre-Photoshop. So since most media images now are altered, the images are even more unrealistic for the majority of women because they literally don't exist in nature. Every blemish, even the unsightly bones protruding from models that are extremely thin, are Photoshopped out. As an extreme example of this, Ralph Lauren came under fire a few years ago for publishing an altered picture of a model in which her pelvis appeared to be narrower than her head. And frankly, the statistics are out there, but we don't really need them to know that women's sense of self-worth and attractiveness is severely impacted by seeing thousands of images each year of what is largely an unattainable body shape. I think it's important to note as well that while at one time this particular body ideal was primarily dominant in the U.S. and Western European countries, the vast expansion of global capitalism over the last several decades has meant that the super thin large-breasted white woman is now a cultural ideal in most of the world, including places that had quite different standards for female beauty just a few decades ago. For many women of color, this has brought along a particular pressure to look more like the white thin ideal. In a journal article titled "Spreading the Religion of Thinness," Michelle Lelwicka points out that there have been documented increases in eating disorders and plastic surgery in a number of countries over the last couple of decades, including South Africa, China, and Lebanon. She also points out that over 50% of the ads in women's magazines in Mexico, Colombia, Chile, and Venezuela featured models described as young, white, and thin. This process of globalizing the super thin body ideal for women only further underscores the fact that this isn't just some sort of natural biological preference that people have, but rather it is manufactured, and it's very specific to the time and place in which we live. So if we know that this is something that's being actively promoted, then the question we need to be asking is who benefits from this pressure on women? And the first and most obvious answer is that there are enormous profits built into promoting women's insecurity with their bodies. And I do want to take a little bit of time to actually look at where the money goes. So to start with the food industry, within the capitalist system, the way businesses survive, of course, is by engaging in a constant drive to maximize profits and growth and to minimize their costs. So the primary result of this in the food industry is that there are horrifically low standards both for the working conditions of agricultural workers and for the food itself, because safety costs money and cuts into their profit margins. The goal is to grow and manufacture food as cheaply as possible. What this has meant is an increasing reliance on food that in many respects isn't really food at all. And it has meant that because these companies control the market, the food that most people have access to is very unhealthy, and our diets are vastly different than they were 60 years ago. This has, of course, contributed to changes in our health. Then during the 1980s, the food industry realized that it could dramatically increase its profits by also capitalizing on people's desire to lose weight. The result was that they started to manufacture so-called health foods using cheaper chemicals to replace standard ingredients. And as Charlene Hesse-Biber pointed out in her book, The Cult of Thinness, which we have at Haymarket, light beer had more water in it, the saccharin in diet drinks was cheaper than sugar, especially profitable were dairy analogs fabricated from inexpensive vegetable fats, margarine, egg substitutes, creamers, frozen dinners, and light cheeses. These diet foods have been an amazing profit windfall for the food industry because not only are they cheaper to produce, but they're often sold at a higher cost because millions of people who are desperately trying to lose weight will actually pay a premium if they think a certain food will help them in that process. Now, of course, there are even more varieties of specialty foods today, including so-called natural foods that cost even more than the diet foods from the same companies. And then, you know, food advertising also, you know, very clearly kind of reflects this relationship that the industry has with sexism and dieting. In 2011, Yoplait pulled an ad off the air after outcry that it essentially promoted eating disorders. And it was a commercial where a thin woman was looking longingly at a slice of raspberry cheesecake and nervously trying to figure out how she could allow herself to indulge. And her ideas were, I can eat it while jogging in place, or I can just eat celery for the rest of the day. Then an even thinner woman came up to the fridge and took a raspberry cheesecake flavored Yoplait yogurt out and walked away. And of course, the first woman, you know, gave up the idea of having the cheesecake and had the yogurt instead. The pushback from eating disorder advocacy groups rightly said that showing a woman having major anxiety over eating a dessert and then deciding to deny herself the dessert only reinforces that this sort of disordered relationship we have to food is normal. But for Yoplait, like for many other companies, this was a logical way to advertise because they want to boost sales by promoting their food as the right choice for women who want to be thin. The flip side of the food industry is, of course, the diet industry. This includes a lot of different types of companies. There are diet programs like Weight Watchers and Jenny Craig, diet books, food replacement products like SlimFast or the Hollywood Cookie Diet, nutritional supplements, prescription drugs, motivational speakers, diet doctors, and probably many more varieties that I haven't even listed. And the very interesting thing about the diet industry is that regardless of the diet or product being promoted, none of them could statistically be said to work. Most estimates are that more than 80% of people who successfully lose weight while dieting regain all of the weight or more weight than they lost after 2 years. It's in the diet industry's interest to blame this on individual failure because it keeps people coming back over and over again. But of course, if other products or medical procedures had an 80% failure rate, they probably wouldn't be able to advertise themselves very confidently anymore. In Laura Fraser's book, Losing It, she talks about how in the 1980s, diet programs like Jenny Craig were openly advertising themselves to highlight the fact that you would need to keep coming back. So Jenny Craig had an ad that compared dieting with getting your hair done. Just something you have to do over and over again to keep it up. Now today, there's a little more awareness about the risks of yo-yo dieting, so they tend to use the language of lifestyle changes instead. But their fundamental model hasn't really shifted. They still rely on people losing weight while they stick to the plan, leaving and gaining the weight back, feeling like a personal failure for regaining the weight, and then signing up for the program again. Of course, beyond the major diet programs, there are a whole host of other segments of the diet industry, some of which are actually quite dangerous. Individuals and companies promote fad diets like the baby food diet, the grapefruit diet, the blood type diet, and on and on. There are numerous supplements that claim to help people lose weight, which are barely or not at all regulated by the FDA. Many major stores, CVS, major drug stores, still sell weight loss cleanses, diuretics, Hoodia, which has been known to cause increased heart rate. And if you really want it, it's still possible to buy Mahuang, which is ephedra, online, which is basically speed. Doctors can still prescribe HCG injections for weight loss, which is a hormone produced by pregnant women that is known to cause headaches, blood clots, and other significant side effects. All of this together adds up to an enormous industry that now makes at least $61 billion a year selling fake solutions to women and some men, some of which are deadly. Then, of course, there's the plastic surgery industry. This industry especially benefits from the fact that the ideal for women's bodies is actually an amalgam of the impossible. Women are supposed to be thin, toned, have tiny hips, flat stomachs, and at the same time have really big breasts. And this rarely occurs naturally. In 2010, over 1.6 million plastic surgery procedures were done, with breast augmentation and liposuction topping the list. And of course, we know that plastic surgeons are notorious for intentionally lowering women's self-esteem in order to convince them to go under the knife. In fact, not long ago, news hit that a plastic surgeon went to a career day at an elementary school in Virginia and brought breast implants for show and tell. Because apparently no girl is too young to realize that her breasts are too small. And the scope of plastic surgery has broadened as well. In recent years, vaginal rejuvenation surgery has become a procedure. It gets worse. Somewhere around 5,000 women in the U.S. get each year. With the most common version being labiaplasty, which includes a procedure called the Barbie, which removes the entire labia minora so that only the outer labia are visible, as smooth as plastic is how they describe it. Frankly, the idea that even vulva are supposed to look a certain way shows just how oppressive the pressure on our bodies is. And it's outrageous that this obsession has reached every part of a woman's body. Although some cosmetic medical procedures are very expensive and limited to, ruling class women, the prevalence of lower cost procedures has been growing quite a bit. A survey of physicians a few years ago showed that Botox is now more commonly used by women who have household incomes between $50,000 and $100,000 than it is by wealthier women. Doctors are intentionally marketing cheap procedures to make more money. In Hesse Biber's book, she quotes a plastic surgeon who talks about the growth of assembly line surgery. He says, in Massachusetts, an MD is licensed to perform any type of plastic surgery he or she wants. If they do not want to spend the money opening up a surgery clinic, all they need to do is team up with an MBA who buys a clinic and says to the doctor, okay, get to work and start doing suction lipectomies as many as you can. There's no law that says he cannot. He can hire an MD with no training and say, we'll show you a movie on how to do it. Now, obviously, this, like many other aspects of this issue, is very closely tied in with the absolutely disgusting profit-based healthcare system in the U.S., because the idea of having factory assembly line-style invasive surgery is really something that only makes sense from the perspective of the person that's profiting from it. But this major profit source also couldn't exist if women weren't being systematically trained to hate their bodies. Rather than cosmetic surgery being a way for people to resolve medical issues or restore their appearance after accidents, it's become another very dangerous way for women to try to reach the cultural standards of beauty. So there are numerous sources of profits to be made for promoting an obsession about weight and beauty among women. Nonetheless, that still doesn't paint the whole picture about what drives this. The massive profits certainly go a long way towards sustaining this pressure on women. But it's also important to situate the diet and beauty industries in the broader context of women's oppression in our society. Beyond the immediate profits, the constant pressure on women to be thin and pretty serves an ideological purpose in the process of maintaining women's oppression in general. On the one hand, as several feminist theorists have pointed out, it causes women to devote an enormous amount of time, energy, and money to fixing themselves, focusing their attention inward to their own faults. Laura Fraser describes this as a third job that women hold, a psychologically exhausting, time-consuming, and expensive job on top of their jobs in the workplace and in the home. But more importantly, I think this focus on women's bodies and appearance trivializes women and reduces their value to their appearance. Mm-hmm. Women in our society are supposed to be defined far more by their looks than by any other aspect of their existence. Women are trained to see themselves as others see them and evaluate their own worth from the assumed preferences of others, specifically men that they have to impress in order to get a man and get married. As Susie Orbach, the author of Fat is a Feminist Issue, put it, to get a man, a woman has to learn to regard herself as an item, a commodity, a sex object. Much of her experience and identity depends on how she and others see her. This emphasis on presentation as the central aspect of a woman's existence makes her extremely self-conscious. It demands that she occupy herself with a self-image that others will find pleasing and attractive, an image that will immediately convey what kind of woman she is. She must observe and evaluate herself, scrutinizing every detail of herself as though she were an outside judge. She attempts to make herself in the image of womanhood presented by billboards, newspapers, magazines, and television. The media present women either in a sexual context or within the family, reflecting a woman's two prescribed roles, first as a sex object, then and then as a mother. She's brought up to marry by catching a man with her good looks and pleasing manner. This process of sexual objectification of women, heavily influenced by media images and the industries we've already discussed, produces an environment in which it is seen as acceptable for individual men to treat women as objects. In many ways, both men and women are trained throughout life to view women's needs and desires as secondary to hypothetical male preferences. As a result, women are bombarded by comments on their body while walking down the street, they endure sexual harassment in the workplace, and ultimately face the threat of rape. This is no coincidence, because the oppression of women is extremely beneficial to the ruling class, and by training all of us to view this as sort of natural and inevitable and just part of our preferences about what women should look like, sexist ideas and practices become ingrained into our world. I don't really have time today to expand on the mechanics behind the role of women's oppression under capitalism, but I would certainly encourage people to attend other sessions at this conference that will look more closely at that. So women's objectification serves an important purpose in reinforcing women's oppression overall. And although objectification of women's bodies has been an issue since at least the early part of the 20th century, it should come as no surprise that we've seen a dramatic increase in this objectification since the 1980s, going along with a right-wing and ruling class backlash to the women's movement. In the last several years, however, this focus on women's bodies has actually expanded to include an intensified effort to shame fat people in general and to blame all manner of social problems on an increase in average body weight. And so at this point, I want to kind of shift my focus to and take a critical look at the what's called the war on obesity. So the common narrative around the war on obesity goes something like this. Due to a massive epidemic of laziness and lack of control, people in the U.S. are becoming fatter. As a result of this, they are contracting serious diseases, draining the healthcare resources of the country, and tearing down the moral fabric of our society. And, of course, you know, most people do view this as primarily an issue of personal responsibility. So, obviously, you know, if people just had the willpower to eat right and exercise, get the right number of calories in versus calories out, the problem will be solved, right? But this ignores a glaring elephant in the room. Why did tens of millions of people suddenly, at the same time, wake up and become lazy and fat when apparently their grandparents weren't? And so the reality is much more complicated than that. In the medical community and in the media, obesity is typically described as an epidemic, mm-hmm. So the same terminology that's used for the H1N1 virus or cholera. As Amy Farrell put it in her book, Fat Shame, with its connotations of disease, contagion, and proliferation, the choice of the term epidemic is deliberately alarmist, suggesting imminent danger and sure catastrophe if not addressed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, just last week, the American Medical Association decided to take this one step further and classify obesity as a disease. Interestingly, in doing this, the AMA delegates actually overrode the recommendation of a committee tasked with studying the issue. So the AMA's Council on Science and Public Health, which had been studying the issue over the last year, said that obesity should not be considered a disease, mainly because the measure usually used to define obesity, the body mass index, the BMI, is simplistic and flawed. They noted that some people with a BMI above the level that usually defines obesity are perfectly healthy, while others below it can have dangerous levels of body fat or metabolic problems. And they also mentioned that the classification of obesity as a disease, conveniently, could cause increased pressure on the FDA to more quickly approve weight loss drugs. Nonetheless, in the face of these recommendations from the committee, the AMA decided to go ahead and classify obesity a disease and effectively label one-third of the U.S. population as sick. Remarkably, the AMA's decision comes in a period in which a number of scientists have raised major questions about the assumption that increases in body weight have actually been the cause of other health problems. Paul Campos and other researchers have argued that a relationship between body mass and mortality only exists at the extreme ends of the spectrum, so a far smaller number of people than are currently labeled overweight, and that it's equally dangerous whether they have a extremely low body mass index or extremely high. Even among the studies that do show increased mortality risk, they typically don't control for fitness level, amount of exercise, diet quality, weight cycling, diet drug use, or family history, all of which have, you know, major impacts on an individual's health. So it is, in fact, very difficult to place any clear causation for medical problems with body weight itself. Campos, Abigail Segoye, and others also argued in a 2006 edition of the International Journal of Epidemiology that the premise, which is assumed by so many, that long-term weight loss will improve health, can't even be tested because there has not been any method found that can consistently produce long-term weight loss. So there's no way to know if that would actually help people get healthier because it can't be done so far. Dieting, on the other hand, and particularly yo-yo dieting, does have proven medical risks. Right. These same researchers singled out financial interests in the industry as a major factor in the way the supposed obesity epidemic is being evaluated. So in the same IJE article, the author said, many of the leading obesity researchers who have created the official standards for what constitutes overweight and obese have also received sizable funding from the pharmaceutical and weight loss industries. These obesity researchers also manage weight loss clinics and have an economic interest in defining unhealthy weight as broadly as possible by overstating the hazards of obesity and thus providing justifications for regulatory approvals as well as for government and insurance industry subsidization of their products. The fact of the matter is that even though people expect that doctors will be more conservative and careful in their approaches, a section of the medical industry has actually endorsed and profited from some of the most dangerous methods of weight loss that exist. Between 1993 and 1997, diet doctors and pharmaceutical executives across the U.S. made a killing on selling Fen-Phen, a drug which eventually caused many people to have pulmonary hypertension and heart valve problems. Diet doctors in nearly every city set up weight loss clinics where they wrote prescriptions for the drug to just about anyone who asked for it. Today, Fen-Phen is banned, but there are new drugs with their own potential side effects to take its place. In addition, something like 200,000 people every year are undergoing risky and invasive bariatric surgery, which is extremely profitable for the healthcare industry, but also carries a number of very serious potential complications for the people who undergo it. I'm not a medical expert myself, and so I don't feel qualified to sort of state definitively whether or not body fat directly causes health problems, but I am confident in saying that there's an enormous amount of evidence that the methods that are being used to address an increase in body weight at best don't really work, and at worst are actually quite harmful to the people that are using them. I think it's worth questioning whether it makes sense to continue to recommend to people that the best thing they can do for their health is to lose weight when there's an enormous amount of evidence that dieting and eating disorders are extremely harmful, and that very few people actually succeed in keeping the weight off long term. Where there is broader agreement in the scientific community, it is in the fact that people's weight on average has been increasing. So, you know, to take a look, you know, for a minute at what might be behind that, I think it's not entirely clear, but outside of sort of, you know, this narrative of people just eating too much, there are a number of factors that are often completely ignored or just brushed over. Perhaps most importantly, we need to be clear that obesity and also diabetes, high cholesterol, et cetera, are all most prevalent in high poverty communities. The rich in this country obviously have boundless access to healthy food, good health care, not to mention things like personal trainers, personal chefs, and on and on. But for people who are struggling to make ends meet, the cheapest food available is often the least healthy. The Food Research and Action Center, FRAC, has some really good resources on this, and they identify several factors contributing to health problems among the poor, including lack of access to healthy food, both because it's expensive and because there are less stores with fresh foods and produce in low-income neighborhoods, cycles of food deprivation and overeating, because when people have food insecurity, once they get money for food, they often overeat, and that inconsistent diet can directly lead to obesity. Mothers are particularly susceptible to this because they will often go longer periods without eating sufficiently in order to feed their children. Limited access to health care and high levels of stress. And I think, you know, we can add to that list the effects of austerity, which has meant the cutting of enormous amounts of critical food resources for poor families and increased pressure on working people to work longer and longer hours. And also the impact of sexism, which, of course, increases stress. So there are a number of broad economic and social trends that are likely contributing to increasing body weights and other health problems. Rather than actually looking at the systematic ways in which working people's health is under attack, though, most discussions about fat place an enormous amount of blame on individuals, thus detracting attention from the people who really have control over the situation. Meanwhile, this blame and stigma placed on working-class people for their health problems or their body size has real effects on people's lives. For one thing, fat people face a large amount of discrimination in a variety of venues. Healthcare is often tainted for people who are overweight. Often doctors will prescribe weight loss as a solution to nearly any physical problem, which means that actual treatment is often deferred or not given to the patient. Self-report studies show that a large percentage of doctors view fat patients as lazy, lacking in self-control, non-compliant, unintelligent, weak-willed, and dishonest. A study of nurses found that 31% said they prefer not to care for obese patients and 24% said that obese patients repulse them. As a result, many fat people are reluctant to seek medical care at all or will delay important preventative care in order to avoid entering a situation where they feel like they're going to experience discrimination. It happens in the workplace as well. Fat women in particular have been shown to get fewer promotions and lower pay than their thinner counterparts. There have also been a growing number of employee wellness programs that penalize employees for not losing weight or adhering to a variety of health standards. Typically, there are increased costs for health care for people who don't comply with those rules. And the pressure on children in particular has been very intense over the last few years, and this is magnified by Michelle Obama's campaign against childhood obesity. Mm-hmm. She frequently invokes nasty stereotypes about fat people to make her point, saying mm-hmm. things directed at parents like, "We can't lie around on the couch eating French fries and candy bars." She has also said that childhood obesity is a public health threat, an economic threat, and a national security threat. I'm not really sure what that means. I mean, maybe fat kids are more likely to support Al-Qaeda. I don't know. And so, you know, even though her campaign has included some, you know, modest legislation to increase food support to low-income families, which is helpful, the impact of the blame she puts on families and individuals is significant. Mm-hmm. In schools over the last several years, there's been growing pressure to enforce body size standards among children. Mm-hmm. Just this year, schools in Andover, Massachusetts sent home fat letters to any family whose student they consider to be obese. A step that obviously further shames and stigmatizes children who are already under an enormous amount of social pressure to lose weight. And we already know that this approach doesn't help people improve their health. Ultimately, the result of blaming and stigmatizing fat people is more disordered eating and more health problems. The effect is particularly stark for women. So I spoke earlier about the way many, many women are obsessed with their weight. For millions of women, this takes the extreme of severe eating disorders. At least 10 million women in the U.S. have anorexia or bulimia. Mm-hmm. And anorexia actually has the highest premature fatality rate of any mental illness. Around 20% of anorexics will die from complications related to the disorder, including suicide and heart failure. So, and this is an epidemic, by the way, that's largely being ignored by the government. So research dollars spent on anorexia average 70 cents per affected individual compared to $159 per individual for schizophrenia. So you can see a bit of a disparity. This is a major problem for young women, but research and treatment is barely being funded. Even beyond the more extreme eating disorders, tens of millions of other women spend an enormous part of their lives in the yo-yo cycle of losing weight and gaining it back over and over again. At any given moment, 50% of American women are on a diet. This is linked to a number of health effects on its own, and it obviously perpetuates the stress and low self-esteem that ultimately leads some in the direction of full-blown eating disorders or depression or suicide. In addition, when officials like Michelle Obama talk about the role of families in properly feeding their children, it's mothers who still primarily bear the responsibility of feeding children in the majority of families. As Natalie Boero argues, implicit in this critique of American culture is a blame of working mothers for allowing their children to watch too much television, for not having their eating habits more closely monitored, and for relying on convenience food for meals. This, of course, is tied to a broader attempt to shame mothers for working as opposed to staying home and cooking and cleaning and raising children. Some media outlets are more obvious in making this argument, like the British Daily Mail, which published an article not long ago titled, "Children with Working Mothers Are Six Times More Likely to Be Fat." So when we really examine it, the war on obesity is really a thinly veiled method for reinforcing individual responsibility, particularly the responsibility of women, and taking away attention from the people who really make the core decisions about what food and health care we have access to. And it's going to be up to us to build an alternative explanation and a plan of action that actually places the blame for the healthcare crisis where it belongs and demands better living conditions for everyone. So with that, I want to kind of finish up by talking about what those solutions might actually look like. Typically, people who have written on these topics take one of two approaches to counteracting the problems within our food system or with women's body image. So the first approach is one often promoted by healthy food advocates, which calls for people to essentially retake control over their food. And this ranges from growing your own gardens to buying organic to cooking all of your meals at home. Now, there's little doubt that those things can lead people to have healthier diets, but the big glaring problem is that none of those options are incredibly accessible to the majority of people who have to devote most of their waking hours to working. This method also doesn't really stand a fighting chance at taking down the massive capitalists that currently control the food system. And so while this may be something that is fulfilling for some individuals, it falls short as a strategy for a mass movement. The second approach is more common among feminists who write on the topic of body image, as well as a lot of fat activists, and that is the love your body approach. The idea is that, you know, we should educate ourselves and each other to get past the cultural expectations of beauty and really learn to love and appreciate our bodies. This is great. You know, I would celebrate anyone reaching that level of acceptance of themselves. But again, this is primarily an individual solution, and it really relies on each of us managing to bypass a constant barrage of pressure on our bodies rather than actually dismantling the institutions that produce that pressure to begin with. One other thing I'll say about the body acceptance approach is that it kind of leaves the door open to corporations trying to profit off of selling us on loving our bodies. Mm-hmm. Dove's Real Beauty campaign is a great example of that. They produce commercials and images that are supposed to challenge the mainstream account of beauty, but then the same company that owns Dove, Unilever, also produces a litany of products that directly reinforce those beauty expectations and sexism, like Axe Body Spray. Women's magazines also play on this. So at the beginning of this talk, I mentioned a Glamour magazine survey on body image. And in that article on body image, they included various tips to improving your own body image. But at the same time, if you look at their website, there are a bunch of links to other articles like "The Surprising Way Flossing Can Help You Lose Weight," "How to Get These Abs Without Doing Crunches," and my personal favorite, "How to Eat Cheese and Not Get Fat." Thank God, I wanted to eat cheese for so long. So, obviously, many activists who promote body acceptance don't want anything to do with these ridiculous sort of corporate attempts to co-opt this message. So it's not as though these are equivalent, but at the end of the day, anything that's fundamentally based on individual transformation can also be very easily commodified. And it's much harder to do that with a mass movement that actually confronts profit. So what can we put forward as some solutions, both to the very unhealthy nature of our food system and to the pervasive sexism that makes women feel horrible about themselves? One thing we can fight for immediately is universal single-payer healthcare that ensures that people's actual needs come before profit in the health system. Beyond just helping people get healthier, this would go a long way towards counteracting the segment of the medical industry that is currently profiting massively off of diet drugs and invasive surgeries, as well as the plastic surgery industry, which is in a constant drive for more patients and increased profits. We can also fight for access to healthy food as a human right, which means opposing austerity measures that attack food stamps or community nutrition programs, but also demanding more. Everyone should have easy, affordable access to fruits, vegetables, and other foods that are high in nutritional value. We need to build a women's movement that calls out sexism for what it is and directly challenges the media images and the industries built around making us feel ashamed of our bodies. A mass movement can effectively challenge the objectification of women, whether in media, on the street, or in the workplace. And frankly, that kind of movement probably will have the effect of helping a lot of us to feel better about ourselves, not only about our bodies, but also about what we can actually achieve in this world. Ultimately, of course, I think the best thing we could do would be to overthrow capitalism. And while there are many other sessions this weekend dealing with revolution and how that works, I will say that there are a number of common sense things that we could do if we had the opportunity to actually make decisions about our lives. We could organize communal kitchens, allowing people to eat healthfully with less effort, expense, and time. We could organize communal daycare and education that is based much more on play and gives children a chance to use their bodies and learn through movement. Communal kitchens and daycare would also, of course, go a long way towards dismantling the sexist division of labor that still dominates women's lives today. And really, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we can reverse the attacks on women and on working people, but it's going to take a hard-fought struggle against the people who are currently profiting off of our misery.
Now we continue with the soundtrack of a video from YouTube. This is entitled Sugar, the Bitter Truth, from July 2009, and the speaker is Professor Robert Lustig. Although there are a few slides, it's still very much possible to get his drift just from listening carefully. I will link to the original YouTube videos. If you'd rather watch that, you can. Again, I've edited out hesitations and interaction with the audience, which doesn't really work so well on radio. Depending on where you're coming from, it might strike you he is making some fairly extraordinary claims, but I would suggest that he has the evidence to back them up. This corresponds very closely with something else that I've been looking into, the Paleolithic diet, basically suggesting that we should try and eat food much more similar to that which our ancestors ate, for which the human being is well adapted. So, no processed foods, not a lot of cooked foods, and very little sugar.
This story dates back about 30 years. This story has a little bit of something for everybody. It has a little bit of biochemistry, a little bit of clinical research, a little bit of public health, a little bit of politics, a little bit of racial innuendo. The only thing it's missing is sex. But we can see what we can do about that too. By the end of the story, I hope I will have debunked the last 30 years of nutrition information in America. And I would very much appreciate it if at the end of the talk you would tell me whether or not I was successful or not. Okay? So, in order to get you in the mood, as it were, let's start with a little quiz. What do the Atkins diet and the Japanese diet have in common? The Atkins diet, of course, is all fat, no carb. The Japanese diet's all carb, no fat. They both work. Right? So what do they share in common? They both eliminate the sugar fructose. Okay? So with that, think about what it means to be on a diet and what macronutrients you're eating and which ones you're not, and then we'll go from there and I'll try to explain how this all works. You've all heard about the obesity epidemic. Here are the numbers. These are the NHANES database body mass index. Everybody knows what that is now. Histograms marching ever rightward as time has gone on, This was what was projected for 2008 in blue. We had so far exceeded and surpassed. This is not even funny. This was from 2003. The reason I show this is not just to show that the obese are getting obeser. Of course, that's true. But in fact, the entire curve has shifted. We all weigh 25 pounds more today than we did 25 years ago, all of us. Now, it is often said that obesity is the ultimate interaction between genetics and environment. And Dr. Christian Vase, who's sitting in the back of the room, will be talking to you next week about the genetic component, which I am also very interested in. But having said that, our genetic pool did not change in the last 30 years. But boy, oh boy, has our environment sure changed. Okay? So tonight, we're going to talk about the environment rather than genes. Okay. Now, in order to talk about the environment, we need to talk about what is obesity. And of course, you're all familiar with the basic concept of the first law of thermodynamics, which states that the total energy inside a closed system remains constant. Now, in human terms, the standard interpretation of this law is the following. If you eat it, you better burn it, or you're going to store it. Now, who here believes that? Oh, come on, you all do. Okay. I used to believe that. I don't anymore. I think that's a mistake. I think that is the biggest mistake, and that is the phenomenon I'm going to try to debunk over the course of the next hour, because I think there's another way to state the law, okay, which is much more relevant and much more to the point. Before I get there, of course, if you believe that, these are the two problems, right? Calories in, calories out. Two behaviors, right? Gluttony and sloth. After all, you see anybody on the street, oh, he's a glutton and a sloth. That's all there is to it. You know, Tommy Thompson said it on the TV show. We just eat too damn much, right? If that were the case, how did the Japanese do this? Why are they doing bariatric surgery on children at Tokyo Children's Hospital today? Why are the Chinese? Why are the Koreans? Why are the Australians? I mean, you know, all these countries who've adopted our diet all suffer now from the same problem. There's another way to state this first law. Okay? And that is, if you're going to store it, that is biochemical forces that drive energy storage, and we'll talk about what they are in a few minutes, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, because energy expenditure and quality of life are the same thing. Things that make your energy expenditure go up make you feel good, like ephedrine, it's off the market, coffee for 2 hours, then you need another hit like me. Things that make your energy expenditure go down, like starvation, hypothyroidism, make you feel lousy. Okay? And how many calories you burn and how good you feel are synonymous. So if you're going to store it, that is an obligate weight gain set up by a biochemical process, and you expect to burn it, that is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, then you're going to have to eat it. And now all of a sudden, these two behaviors, the gluttony and the sloth, are actually secondary to a biochemical process, which is primary. And that's a different way to think about the process. And it also alleviates the obese person from being the perpetrator, but rather the victim, which is how obese people really feel. Because no one chooses to be obese. Certainly no child chooses to be obese. Oh, you say, oh, yeah, sure, I know some adults who don't care. You know, Rossini, the famous composer, you know, La Gazza Larga, Marriage of Figaro, and all that, he retired at age 37 to a lifetime of gastronomic debauchery. Okay, maybe he chose to be obese. Okay, but the kids I take care of in obesity clinic do not choose to be obese. In fact, this is the exception that proves the rule. We have an epidemic of obese six-month-olds. Now, if you want to say that it's all about diet and exercise, then you have to explain this to me. So any hypothesis that you want to proffer that explains the obesity epidemic, you've got to explain this one too. Okay? And this is not just in America, these six-month-old obese kids, but these are around the world now. Let's talk about calorie intake, because that's what today is about. We're going to talk about the energy intake side of the equation. Okay? Sure enough, we are all eating more now than we did 20 years ago. Teen boys are eating 275 calories more. American adult males are eating 187 calories more per day. American adult females are eating 335 calories more per day. No question. We're all eating more. Question is, why? How come? Because it's all there? You know what? It was there before. There's a system in our body, which you've heard about over the last couple of weeks, called leptin. Everybody heard of leptin? Okay? It's this hormone that comes from your fat cell, tells your brain, you know what, I've had enough. I don't need to eat anymore. I'm done. And I can burn energy properly. Well, you know what? If you're eating 187 or 335 calories more today than you were 20 years ago, your leptin ain't working. Because if it were, you wouldn't be doing it, whether the food was there or not. There's something wrong with our biochemical negative feedback system that normally controls energy balance. And we have to figure out what caused it and how to reverse it. And that's what tonight is about. But nonetheless, there are 275 calories we have to account for. So where are they? Are they in the fat? No, they're not in the fat. 5 grams, 45 calories out of the 275, nothing. In fact, it's all in the carbohydrate. 57 grams, 228 calories. We're all eating more carbohydrate. Now, you all know back in 1982, the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture admonished us to reduce our total fat consumption from 40 to 30%. Everybody remember that? Okay, that's how Entenmann's fat-free cakes came into being. Remember that? So what happened? We've done it. 40% down to 30%. And look what's happened to the obesity, metabolic syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, cardiovascular disease, stroke prevalence, all jacked way up as our total fat consumption percent, as a percent, has gone down. It ain't the fat, people. It ain't the fat. So what is it? Well, it's the carbohydrate. Specifically, which carbohydrate? Well, beverage intake, right? 41% increase in soft drinks, 35% increase in fruit drinks, fruit aids, whatever you want to call them. Just remember, down here, one can of soda a day is 150 calories. Multiply that by 365 days a year, and then divide that by the magic number of 3,500 calories per pound. If you eat or drink 3,500 calories more than you burn, you will gain 1 pound of fat. Okay? That's the first law of thermodynamics. No argument there. That's worth 15 and a half pounds of fat per year. One soda a day is 15 and a half pounds per year. Now, you've all heard that before. That's not news to you. The question is, how come we don't respond? How come leptin doesn't work? How come we can't stay energy stable? That's what we're going to get to. So, I call this slide very specifically the Coca-Cola conspiracy. Anybody here work for Coke? Pepsi? Okay, good. All right, so this over here, 1915, the first standardized bottle of Coca-Cola out of Atlanta. Anybody remember this bottle? Sure, a lot of you do, right? I remember this bottle because my grandfather in Brooklyn took me on Saturday afternoon down to the local soda shop on Avenue M and Ocean Avenue, and every Saturday afternoon I had one of these. I remember it very well. Now, if you drank one of those every day, assuming, of course, that the recipe hasn't changed, because, after all, only two people in the world know the recipe, and they're not allowed to fly in the plane at the same time, right? You know that, okay? Assuming the recipe hasn't changed, if you drank one of those every day for a year, 6.5 ounces, that would be worth 8 pounds of fat per year, okay? Now, in 1955, after World War II, and sugar became plentiful again and wasn't being rationed, we have the appearance of the 10-ounce bottle, the first one that was found in vending machines. And you probably remember that one as well. Then in 1960, the ever-ubiquitous 12-ounce can, worth 16 pounds of fat per year. And of course, today, this over here is the single unit of measure, right? 20 ounces. Anybody know how many servings are in that bottle? 2.5 8-ounce servings, that's right. Anybody know, anybody who gets 2.5 8-ounce servings out of that bottle? That's a single serving, right? Okay. So that would be worth 26 pounds of fat per year if you did that every day. And then, of course, over here we have the 7-Eleven Big K Thirst Buster, Big Gulp, whatever you want to call it. 44 ounces worth 57 pounds of fat per year. And if that wasn't bad enough, my colleague Dr. Dan Hale at the University of Texas San Antonio tells me that down there they got a Texas-sized Big Gulp. 60 ounces of Coca-Cola, a Snickers bar, and a bag of Doritos, all for 99 cents. Okay, so if you did that every day for a year, that would be worth 112 pounds of fat per year. So why do I call it the Coca-Cola conspiracy? Well, what's in Coke? Caffeine, good, good. So what's caffeine? It's a mild stimulant, right? It's also a diuretic, right? Makes you pee free water. What else is in Coke? Salt. 55 milligrams of sodium per can. It's like drinking a pizza. So what happens if you take on sodium and lose free water? You get thirstier, right? So why is there so much sugar in Coke? To hide the salt. When was the last time you went to a Chinese restaurant and had sweet and sour pork? That's half soy sauce. You wouldn't eat that. Except the sugar plays a trick on your tongue. You can't even tell it's there. Everybody remember New Coke, 1985? More salt, more caffeine. They knew what they were doing. That's the smoking gun. They know. All right, so that's why it's the Coca-Cola conspiracy. So, are soft drinks the cause of obesity? Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask the scientists for the National Soft Drink Association, they'll tell you there's absolutely no association between sugar consumption and obesity. Okay? If you ask my colleague, Dr. David Ludwig, remember, I'm Lustig, he's Ludwig. Okay? He does what I do at Boston Children's Hospital. Someday we're going to open a law firm. Each additional sugared sweetened drink increase over a 19-month follow-up period in kids increased their BMI by this much and their odds-risk ratio for obesity by 60%. That's a prospective study on soft drinks and obesity, the real deal. If you look at meta-analyses, everybody know what a meta-analysis is? Okay, it's a conglomeration of numerous studies subjected to rigorous statistical analysis. 88 cross-sectional and longitudinal studies regressing soft drink consumption against energy intake, body weight, milk and calcium intake, adequate nutrition, all showing significant associations, and some of these being longitudinal. This came from Kelly Brownell's group at Yale. Okay? I should comment, disclaimer, those studies that were funded by the beverage industry showed consistently smaller effects than those that were independent. Wonder why. Now, how about the converse? What if you take the soft drinks away? So this was the fizzy drink study from Christchurch, England, James et al., British Medical Journal, where they went into schools and they took the soda machines out, okay? Just like we did here in California. We haven't seen the data yet, but they went and did it for a year. So the prevalence of obesity in the intervention school stayed absolutely constant, no change, whereas the prevalence of obesity in the control schools, where nothing changed, continued to rise over the year. Okay, so that's pretty good. How about type 2 diabetes? Are soft drinks the cause of type 2 diabetes? Well, this study from JAMA in 2004 looked at the relative risk ratio of all soft drinks, cola, fruit punch, and found a very statistically significant trend of sugared soft drinks, fruit aids, et cetera, causing type 2 diabetes. And you know we've got just as big a problem with type 2 diabetes as we do with obesity for the same reasons. And this was a sugared sweetened beverage against risk for type 2 diabetes in African-American women. Looking here at sugared sweetened soft drinks, just the downward arrow shows that there was a significant rise as the number of drinks went up. You can see that here, whereas orange and grapefruit juice, interestingly, did not. Two different studies, two different increases in type 2 diabetes relative to soft drink consumption. So what's in soft drinks? Well, in America, it's this stuff, right? High fructose corn syrup. Everybody's heard of it, right? It's been demonized, something awful. So much so that the corn refiners industry has launched a mega campaign to try to absolve high fructose corn syrup of any problems, which we'll talk about in a moment, okay? But the bottom line is, this is something we were never exposed to before, 1975, and currently we are consuming 63 pounds per person per year, every one of us, 63 pounds of high fructose corn syrup.
That's American?
That's American, yes. What is high fructose corn syrup? Well, you'll see in a minute. It's one glucose, one fructose. We'll talk about those at great length. One of the reasons we use high fructose corn syrup is because it's sweeter. So here's sucrose. This is cane or beet sugar, standard table sugar, you know, the white stuff, okay? And we give that an index in sweetness of 100. So here's high fructose corn syrup. It's actually sweeter. It's about 120. So you should be able to use less, right? Wrong. We use just as much. In fact, we use more. So here's lab fructose over here, if you had crystalline fructose. And they're starting to put crystalline fructose into some of the soft drinks. You can, they're actually advertising it as a good thing. And that's got a sweetness of 173. So you should be able to cut that way back, right? They're not. Lactose down here, milk sugar, it's not sweet at all. Okay? And glucose, I should point out over here, is 74. It's not particularly sweet, and we're going to get to that at the end. Okay, and what goes on with glucose. Right? But anyway, there's why we use it. It's sweeter. It's also cheaper, as I'll show you. So here's high fructose corn syrup. One glucose, one fructose. Notice the glucose is a six-membered ring. The fructose is a five-membered ring. They are not the same. Believe me, they're not the same. That's what this whole talk is about, is how they're not the same. Okay, and here's sucrose, and they're just bound together by this ether linkage. We have this enzyme in our gut called sucrase. It kills that bond in 2 seconds flat, okay, and you absorb it. And basically, high fructose corn syrup, sucrose, it's a non-issue. It's a wash. They're the same. Okay? And they know that that they're the same, the soft drink companies and the corn refiners, because here are their misses. Okay? This comes from the Corn Refiners Association. Obesity research shows high fructose corn syrup metabolizes and impacts satiety similar to sugar. Indeed it does. I agree. At academic meetings around the country. Okay? Hunger and satiety profiles energy intakes following ingestion of soft drinks. Bottom line, research supported by the American Beverage Institute and the Corn Refiners Association. They are correct. There is absolutely no difference between high fructose corn syrup and sucrose. So much so that the Corn Refiners Association, in an attempt to capture market share, came out with this entire ad campaign. You probably saw it on the back page of the New York Times. Okay, it was on TV. It's everywhere. My hairdresser says that sugar is healthier than high fructose corn syrup. Wow, you get your hair done by a doctor? I didn't know I could cut hair. If you all want to see all of them, there are a whole bunch of them. You can go to www.sweetsurprise.com and see how you're being hoodwinked. Okay? But indeed, this is true. High fructose corn syrup and sucrose are exactly the same. They're both equally bad. They're both poison. Okay? I said it. Poison. My charge before the end of tonight is to demonstrate that fructose is a poison. And I will do it. And you will tell me if I was successful. Nonetheless, here's Center for the Science and the Public Interest and the Corn Refiners Association. Everybody remember last year when Gavin Newsom floated a soda tax? Governor Patterson of New York has since floated one, and other people are starting to talk about it. So why are they saying this? Well, they're saying obesity is a problem, kids are drinking soda, let's tax it. So they're talking about soda like it's empty calories. I'm here to tell you that it goes way beyond empty calories. The reason why this is a problem is because fructose is a poison. Okay? It's not about the calories. It's not has nothing to do with the calories. It's a poison by itself. And I'm going to show you that. Nonetheless, I just want to read you this paragraph here, okay, in yellow. We respectfully urge that the proposal be revised as soon as possible to reflect the scientific evidence that demonstrates no material differences in the health effects of high fructose corn syrup and sugar. I agree. Here's the important sentence. The real issue is that excessive consumption of any sugars may lead to health problems. Not may, does. Does. So here's the secular trend in fructose consumption over the past 100 years. Before we had food processing, we used to get our fructose from fruits and vegetables. And if we did that, today we would consume about 15 grams per day of fructose. Not sugar, fructose. Sugar would be 30 grams, it would be double. Okay, we're just talking about fructose today. Prior to World War II, we were up to about 16 to 24, about 20 grams. So a small increase from the beginning of the century to World War II. Then, in 1977, just as high fructose corn syrup was hitting the market, we had increased that. We had basically doubled up to 37 grams per day, or 8% of total caloric intake. By 1994, we were up to 55 grams of the stuff per day. Remember, if you want to do sugar, then double the number. So that's 10.2. So you can see that more and more of our caloric intake, higher percentage, is being accounted for by sugar every single year. So it's not just that we're eating more. We're eating more sugar. And for adolescents today, we're up to almost 75 grams, 12% of total caloric intake. 25% of adolescents today consume at least 15% of their calories from fructose alone. This is a disaster. An absolute unmitigated disaster. The fat's going down, the sugar's going up, and we're all getting sick. Now let me show you why. So this is where the politics comes in. This is the perfect storm. And it was created from three political winds that swirled around all at the same time. The first political wind, everything bad that ever happened in this country started with one man. So Richard Nixon, in his paranoia back in 1972, food prices were going up and down and up and down. I'm going to show you that on the next slide. And he was worried that this was actually going to cost him the election. So he admonished his Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Rusty Butz, I love that name, to basically take food off the political table, to make food a non-issue in presidential elections. Well, the only way to do that was to make food cheap. So he was out to find all methods to be able to decrease the price of food. Remember Nixon's war on poverty? We're suffering from it today. Second political wind, the advent of high fructose corn syrup. Okay? So this was invented in 1966 at Saga Medical School in Japan by a guy named Takasaki, who's still alive. As far as I'm concerned, this stuff is Japan's revenge for World War II. Except, of course, that they're suffering from it now themselves. Okay? Like everything, you know, it always comes back to haunt you. And it was introduced to the American market in 1975. So what do you think happened to the price of sugar when this thing hit the market? Up and down. Here's where corn sweeteners entered the market, 1975, 1980. And you can see that since then, the price of sugar has remained remarkably constant. And it did so not just in the U.S., but also on the international stage. Here's the London price doing the same thing. And when you look at the difference in price between sugar and high fructose corn syrup, you can see that high fructose corn syrup is about half the price. So in other words, it's cheap. So high fructose corn syrup is evil, but it's not evil because it's metabolically evil. It's evil because it's economically evil, because it's so cheap that it's found its way into everything. It's found its way into hamburger buns, pretzels, barbecue sauce, and ketchup. Somebody emailed me the other day and told me they went into their local grocery store and went through every single loaf of bread on the shelf. And out of 32 types of bread on the shelf, only one of them did not have high fructose corn syrup in it. So we are being poisoned by this stuff, and it's been added surreptitiously to all of our food, every processed food. Okay, and the question is, why? The corn refiners like to point out, well, you know, it's just been a substitution. As the high fructose corn syrup's gone up, the sugar's gone down. You know, we're just replacing, you know, like gram for gram. Well, not exactly. Because here's 73 pounds of sugar per year. This is from the Economic Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, disappearance data. 73 pounds up to 95 pounds by 2000. And there's something missing from this slide. Juice is missing, because juice is sucrose, right? Okay. So this is a study done by Miles Faith, a prospective study in inner city Harlem toddlers. And the number of juice servings per day predicts the change in BMI score per month in these inner-city Harlem toddlers. Now, where do these inner-city Harlem toddlers get their juice? From where? From whom? From WIC. You know what WIC is? Women, Infants, Children, right? A government entitlement program set up under who? Nixon, okay? To prevent failure to thrive? They did. This is the equal and opposite reaction. So let's add juice in. Here it is. And so most fructose items, when you put it together, now we're up to 113 pounds on this graph. And I just heard from Brian Williams of NBC News after the most recent study came out that was in the Journal of Clinical Investigation that we are actually up to 141 pounds of sugar per year, each of us. That's what we're up to, 141 pounds of sugar per year. Now, do you think that this might have some detrimental effects on you? Hasn't stopped you, has it? That's the point. It hasn't stopped you. That's why we need to talk about this. So juice consumption increases the risk for type 2 diabetes. Okay. So this is the relative risk ratio as juice intake goes up. And this is in the nurse's study, okay, showing, again, juice consumption, sucrose, obesity, diabetes. The third political storm, okay, that swirling around to create this disaster, this mega typhoon, that happened in 1982. The USDA, the American Heart Association, the American Medical Association, all telling us we had to reduce our consumption of fat. Now, why did they tell us that? To stop heart disease, did we? No, we didn't. In fact, it's worked the exact opposite. We've only created more. So now, how did this come to be? Why did they tell us to stop eating fat? Well, in the early 1970s, we discovered something in our blood called LDL. Low-density lipoproteins. You've heard of that, right? Is it good or bad? Not so bad. We'll talk about it. In the mid-1970s, we learned that dietary fat raised your LDL. So if dietary fat is A and LDL is B, we learned that A led to B. Okay, dietary fat definitely increases your LDL. No argument. It's true. Okay. And then, finally, in the late 1970s, we learned that LDL correlated with cardiovascular disease. Okay, so let's call cardiovascular disease C. So we learned that B led to C. So the thought process by some very smart nutritionists, et cetera, you know, the USDA, et cetera, said, well, if A leads to B and B leads to C, then A must lead to C. Therefore, no A, no C. This was the logic. Now, any logicians in the room? Anybody see any problems with that logic? That's right. The premise is incorrect because this suggests that this is all transitive, but in fact, only the contrapositive is transitive. So it's not no A, no C. It's no C, no A. There's faulty logic here. But before I show you why it doesn't work, I'm going to show you that this was a battle royal back in the 1970s. This was not a simple thing. There were people lined up on both sides of this story. So this, over here, is a book. 1972 it came out. And it was called Pure, White, and Deadly. It's all about sugar. Written by a British physiologist, nutritionist, endocrinologist by the name of John Yudkin. Now, I never knew John Yudkin. He's passed away. But I read this book about a year ago, and without even knowing it, I was a Yudkin acolyte. I was a Yudkin disciple. Every single thing that this man said in 1972 is the God's honest truth. And if you want to read a true prophecy, you find this book. It's not easy to find, but you go find this book, and I'm telling you, every single thing this guy said has come to pass. It's astounding. I am in awe of this guy. But on the other side, we had this guy over here. Okay, his name was Ansel Keys. Anybody heard of him? Okay, so Ansel Keys was a Minnesota epidemiologist, very interested in the cause of cardiovascular disease, and he performed the first multivariate regression analysis without computers. Now, anybody know what that means? Multivariate regression analysis? Okay, so this is where you take a whole lot of data. Okay, and normally you would just, you know, run a few computer programs. But basically the object is to try to figure out what causes what and to try to factor out other things and determine what the contribution of various things all at once are to an outcome that you're looking for. So he was interested in cardiovascular disease. And so what he did was he did this study along with other people around the world called the Seven Countries Study. Very famous, front page of Time magazine in 1980. So here's the data on the seven-country study. We have the U.S., we have Canada, Australia, England, Wales, Italy, Japan. Okay? And here's percent calories from fat on the x-axis, and here we have coronary disease death rate on the y-axis. And so you'd say, well, look at that. I mean, it's very obvious, isn't it? Sure, percent calories from fat correlates very nicely with coronary disease, except for one little problem, Japan and Italy. So how much sugar do they eat? Didn't I tell you the Japanese diet eliminates fructose? They never even had it till we brought it to them after World War II. Italy, you know, aside from gelato, I mean, what else they got? Okay? They got a lot of pasta, there's a lot of glucose, but no fructose. Okay? There's no sugar in the Italian diet other than the occasional sweet, which they moderate. They're very careful about moderating, and they cost a lot. But here we got England, Wales, Canada, Australia, U.S. You know, we are sugarholics, aren't we? We're also fataholics. So, in fact, the fat migrated with the sugar. So here's, this is from Keyes' own work, okay, page 262, if you want to pick up the 500-page volume. And I'm just going to read you the one paragraph, okay, that talks about this. The fact that the incidence rate of coronary heart disease was significantly correlated with the average percentage of calories from sucrose in the diet is explained by the intercorrelation of sucrose with saturated fat. In other words, donuts. Wherever there was the fat, there was sucrose too, because these guys here eat donuts. Partial correlation analysis show that with saturated fat constant, there was no significant correlation between dietary sucrose and the incidence of coronary heart disease. Okay. When you do a multivariate linear regression analysis, you have to do it both ways. You have to do holding fat constant, showing that sucrose doesn't work, and then you have to hold sucrose constant and show that fat still works. You see that anywhere? He didn't do it. He didn't do the thing that you need to do a multivariate linear regression analysis. Now, this was done before computers. We can't check the work. He's dead. He died in 2004. So we're left with a conundrum. Do we believe this? Do we believe this study? Because we based 30 years of nutrition, education, and information and policy in this country on this study. And as far as I'm concerned, it has a hole as big as the one in the USS Cole. Remember I told you LDL, maybe not so bad? Well, here's why. Because there really isn't one LDL. There are two. Here's one over here. It's called pattern A or large buoyant LDL. So everybody knows that LDL correlates with cardiovascular disease, and that's true, and I'm not going to argue that, that is true, but it's not this one, pattern A LDL. These guys are so light, they are buoyant, they float. So they get carried through the bloodstream, and they don't even have a chance because they're so big and they're so buoyant, they don't even get underneath the edge of the endothelial cells in the vasculature to start the plaque formation process. But over here, we have this other guy over here called pattern B, or small, dense LDL. You see the difference? These guys are dense. These guys don't float. These guys are small. They get underneath the edge of the surface of the endothelial cells, and they start the plaque formation. And it's been shown by numerous investigators now that small, dense LDL is the bad guy. Okay, now, when we measure LDL in the bloodstream, when you do a lipid profile, you measure both of them together because it's too hard to distinguish the two. So when you get an LDL, you're getting both LDLs, the neutral one and the bad one. Now, how can you tell whether your LDL is the neutral one or the bad one? What you do is you look at your triglyceride level in association with it, because your triglycerides tell you which one it is. So here's pattern A over here, okay? Big, large, buoyant LDLs, okay? And you'll notice that the triglycerides are low and your HDL is high. That's what you want. You want a low triglyceride, high HDL, because that's the good cholesterol. You want good cholesterol. Over here you have pattern B, and here you have high triglyceride, low HDL. That's the bad guy. That's the guy you don't want to be, because you're going to die of a heart attack. No question about it. Triglyceride to HDL ratio actually predicts cardiovascular disease way better than LDL ever did. Point is, when you measure LDL, you measure both. So, dietary fat raises your large buoyant. What do you think raises your small dense? Carbohydrate. Okay, so here's percent carbohydrate, and here's your pattern B going up. Everybody got it? What did we do in 1982? We went on a high-carb diet, which was supposed to be a low-fat diet, right? So here's the low-fat craze. Took America and the world by storm, because the content of low-fat, home-cooked food that you cook by yourself in your house, you can control the content of fat. But when you low-fat processed food, it tastes like cardboard. The food companies knew that, so what did they do? They had to make it palatable. So how do you make it something palatable that has no fat in it? You add the sugar. So everybody remember Snackwells? Okay, so 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up, 4 of them being sugars so that it was palatable. Well, we've just shown you that that's the worst thing you could do. And that's what we've done. And we're still doing it today. So when you find a mistake, what do? You admit the mistake and you right the ship. We haven't admitted the mistake and we haven't righted the ship. So we've had our food supply adulterated, contaminated, poisoned, tainted, on purpose. And we've allowed it through the addition of fructose for palatability, especially because of the decreased fat, and also as a ostensibly browning agent, which actually has its own issues, because why it browns so well with the sugar in it actually is what's going on in your arteries, because that's causing what we call protein glycation and cross-linking, which is actually contributing to atherosclerosis. So it works on your steak, on the grill. It works in your arteries the same way. And removal of fiber also. Now, why did we remove fiber from our diet? We as human beings walking the earth 50,000 years ago used to consume 100 to 300 grams of fiber per day. We now consume 12. What did we do? So why did we take the fiber out? Well, it takes too long to cook, takes too long to eat, and shelf life. So people ask me, what's the definition of fast food? Fiberless food. Okay? I dare you, other than a salad, I dare you to go to any fast food restaurant and find anything on their menu that they actually have to cook that has more than 1 gram of fiber in it, because there isn't any. And that's on purpose, because they take the fiber out, because that way they can freeze it, ship it around the world, and cook it up fast. And not only is it fast cooking, but it's fast eating, which also causes its own satiety issues. Bottom line, we have a typhoon on our hands. Okay? And then finally, the last issue was the substitution of trans fats, which are clearly a disaster. But those have been going down because we know that those are a problem. So we've gotten rid of most trans fats. Not completely, but most. So this is it. This is what we've done over the last 30 years. Now to the biochemistry. I am going to show you a lot of reactions in excruciating detail. So what I'm going to suggest that you all do is just let me do my thing to show you that it, at least it works, and just count the arrows. And let me show you why fructose is not glucose. Okay? Because what the liver does to fructose is really unique, and you've got to understand it to understand everything I've just told you. So number one, fructose is 7 times more likely than glucose to do that browning reaction, the advanced glycosylation end products. The thing that happens on your grill happens in your arteries for the same reason. Okay? You can actually see the color, too, color change, too. Fructose does not suppress the hunger hormone. There's a hormone that comes from your stomach called ghrelin you've heard about already. Okay? So when you, if you preload a kid with a can of soda and then you let them loose at the fast food restaurant, do they eat more or do they eat less? They eat more. They just took on 150 calories, yet they eat more. Reason? Because fructose doesn't suppress the hunger hormone ghrelin. So they eat more. Acute fructose ingestion does not stimulate insulin because there's no receptor for fructose, no transporter for fructose on the beta cell that makes insulin. So the insulin doesn't go up. Well, if the insulin doesn't go up, then leptin doesn't go up. And if leptin doesn't go up, your brain doesn't see that you ate something. Therefore, you eat more. And finally, I'm going to show you liver hepatic fructose metabolism is completely different between fructose and glucose. Completely different. And I'm going to show you before the day is out, the evening's out, that chronic fructose exposure alone, nothing else, causes this thing we call the metabolic syndrome. Everybody knows what the metabolic syndrome is? Okay, so this is the conglomerate of the following different phenomena: obesity, type 2 diabetes, lipid problems, hypertension, and cardiovascular disease. Those all cluster together, called metabolic syndrome. I'm going to show you how fructose does every one of those. I want to show you the difference between glucose and fructose in a way that will be glaringly apparent. So let's consume 120 calories in glucose, 2 slices of white bread. What happens to that 120 calories? 80% of the total will be used by all the organs in the body. Why? Because every cell in the body can use glucose. Every bacteria can use glucose. Every living thing on the face of the earth can use glucose because glucose is the energy of life. Okay? That's what we were supposed to eat. 20% will hit the liver. So let's watch what happens to those 24 calories. Here they go. So the glucose comes in through this transporter called GLUT2. Out here, the glucose is going to stimulate the pancreas to make insulin. The insulin is going to bind to its receptor, and it's going to take this substrate over here called IRS1, insulin receptor substrate 1. That's not important right now. Don't worry. Okay? And it's going to tyrosine phosphorylate it. Okay? And it's going to be tyrosine IRS1, which is now active. That's active. And it's going to stimulate this second messenger here called AKT. Now, what AKT does is it stimulates this guy down here, SREBP1, sterol receptor binding protein number 1. Don't worry about it. Okay? But this is the thing that ultimately gets fat mechanics going. Okay? So you'll see in a minute. So one of the things that SREBP1 does is it activates this enzyme here called glucokinase, which takes glucose to glucose-6-phosphate. Now, glucose-6-phosphate can't get out of the liver. The only way to get glucose-6-phosphate out of the liver is with hormones, glucagon or epinephrine. That's the way you can get it out. So now the glucose is fixed in the cell, but it's only 24 calories worth. So it's not a big, you know, bolus of it. Okay? Now, the glucose-6-phosphate, almost all of it is going to end up going over here to something called glycogen. Now, glycogen is the storage form of glucose in the liver, okay? Because glycogen is easy to fish the glucose out with glucagon and epinephrine. So my question to you, and granted this is a physiology question, is how much glycogen can your liver store before it gets sick? The answer is any amount, unlimited. Okay? We have carb loaders who run marathons, right? Okay, does it hurt them at all? We have kids with a disease where they can't get the glucose out of the glycogen called glycogen storage disease type 1A or von Gierke's disease. They got livers down to their knees. They're so big. They're hypoglycemic like all get out because they can't lift the glucose out of their liver. Okay? But they don't go into liver failure because glycogen is a non-toxic storage form of glucose in the liver. So the whole goal of glucose is to replete your glycogen. So this is good. This is not bad. This is good. Now, a little of that glucose is going to fall down here. It's going to get metabolized down to this stuff here called pyruvate. And the pyruvate is going to enter your mitochondria over here. Remember, your mitochondria are the parts of your cell that actually burn the energy. They're your little factories. Okay, they make the stuff that lets you live, okay, called ATP, ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That's the energy of life right there. Okay, so the pyruvate comes in, gets converted to something called acetyl-CoA, gets metabolized by this thing called the Krebs cycle, TCA cycle, and you throw off ATP and carbon dioxide, which you breathe off. So far, so good? I'm doing my best. I swear to God, I'm doing my best. Anyway, so this stuff over here, this acetyl-CoA, gets burned off in the TCA cycle. Now, maybe you won't burn all of it off, and so some of it may exit as citrate, okay? And the citrate then leaves the mitochondria through a process known as the citrate shuttle, and then that citrate can then be broken down by these three enzymes, which are all subservient to this SREBP1. This is ATP citrate lyase, acetyl-CoA carboxylase, fatty acid synthase. They're not important. The only thing to know is these three enzymes together turn sugar into fat. This is called de novo, meaning new, lipogenesis, fat making. Okay? This is de novo lipogenesis. So you take the citrate, which came from the glucose, okay, and you end up with something called acyl-CoA, which then gets packaged with this protein here, and you end up with something called VLDL, very low density lipoprotein. Now, anybody heard of that before? That's bad. Okay? VLDL is bad because that's one of the things that causes heart disease. It's also a substrate for obesity. Okay? So you don't want to make much of this. Okay? But the point is, you started with 24 calories, maybe a half a calorie will end up as VLDL. So that little Japanese guy with the little hat, you know, working out in the field, eating rice for the next, you know, 90 years, you know, can he die of a heart attack at age 90? Sure. Okay? But that's not so bad. Okay? If you make it to 90, you're doing all right. Okay? Because of that VLDL coming from glucose. Okay? Glucose made a little bitty VLDL. Okay? And that serves as a substrate for adipose deposition into your fat cell here, triglyceride. In addition, because the insulin went up in response to the glucose, your brain sees that signal, and it knows that that is supposed to shut off further eating. In other words, hey, I'm busy metabolizing my breakfast. I don't need lunch. And so you have a nice negative feedback loop between glucose consumption, the liver, the pancreas, and the brain to keep you in normal, negative, yin-yang energy balance. This is good. This is not dangerous. This is what's supposed to happen. All right, so now let's talk about a different carbohydrate. Let's talk about my favorite carbohydrate, maybe yours too, ethanol. Here's the structure, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. It's a carbohydrate, but we all know that ethanol is a toxin, right? A poison. You can wrap your Lamborghini around a tree, or you can fry your liver. Your choice. Depends on how much you drink and how often, right? So we know that ethanol is not good for you, except, of course, a little bit is good for you, right? So we can talk about that, too, later if you want. Okay? But let's talk about how it's bad for you. So here's acute ethanol exposure. CNS depression, vasodilatation, hypothermia, tachycardia, myocardial depression, pupillary responses, respiratory depression, diuresis, hypoglycemia, loss of fine motor control. You all went to college. Here's fructose. Nothing. Doesn't do any of those because the brain doesn't metabolize fructose. Okay? Alcohol gets metabolized in the brain to cause all of those things, but fructose doesn't. Okay? So fructose is not an acute toxin. Ethanol is. We control ethanol, don't we? Okay? We have something called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, right? We have all sorts of things. We tax ethanol. We do all sorts of things to limit consumption of ethanol. Okay? The Nordic countries, okay, all the liquor stores are state-run in an attempt to try to set the price of ethanol high enough so as to discourage consumption for public health reasons. We have 1,500 years of alcohol control policy in this world to draw on in terms of how to limit consumption. Got it? Okay? Because ethanol is a toxin and we know it. So let's consume 120 calories in ethanol. Shot a maker's mark. 24 calories right off the top. Okay, the stomach and the intestine have something called the first pass effect, so 10% off the top, and kidney, muscle, and brain will consume the other 10%. So there goes 20% or 24 calories right off the top. 96 calories of the 120 are going to hit the liver. Now, how many was it for glucose? It was 24. Okay, so four times the substrate is going to hit the liver, and there's the rub. OK, Okay? This is a volume issue. Okay? We're going to show you how. So the ethanol comes in, passive diffusion. There's no receptor for it, no transporter. First thing that happens is ethanol gets converted to this guy over here called acetaldehyde. Okay? Anybody know anything about aldehydes? Like formaldehyde? Right? Are aldehydes good for you or bad for you? They're bad, right? Because what do? They can cause cancer. They cross-link proteins is what they do. Okay? So if you cross-link enough proteins in your liver, what do you think happens to it? You get something called cirrhosis. Right, exactly. All right. So this guy over here is bad. Okay? And it generates something called reactive oxygen species. And reactive oxygen species damage proteins in the liver. And the more alcohol you drink, the more of this stuff you get. So far, so good? Okay, so this is one of the reasons why alcohol is bad. Now, the acetaldehyde will come down here to something called acetate. Okay, the acetate will enter the mitochondria, just like the pyruvate did before, will get converted to acetyl-CoA and participate in the TCA cycle, just like before, okay, to generate energy, you know, so that alcoholics don't die from, you know, from lack of energy. They got energy, it's everything else they don't have. Okay, they're going to have a whole lot of citrate because they have 96 calories that have to get metabolized. How many calories made it to the mitochondria with glucose? About a half, right? Because most of it went to glycogen. Okay? So we've got a big citrate. So it's in big font to show you that we've talked about big citrate now. And so the big citrate is going to get metabolized all the way to VLDL by this SRBP1. And so you're going to get a lot of VLDL. And this is the dyslipidemia of alcoholism right here. Okay, everybody see that? So the liver's going to try to export this VLDL out so that it doesn't get sick, because when fat builds up in the liver, that's not good for it. Some of it's going to exit as free fatty acids, and those free fatty acids will take up residence in the muscle, and you get something called muscle insulin resistance. So insulin resistance, that's a bad thing. That makes your muscles and your liver not work so well and can cause all sorts of other problems like diabetes. Some of the acyl-CoA won't even make it out and will precipitate as a lipid droplet. So there's your alcoholic steatohepatitis. This acyl-CoA and this ethanol and these reactive oxygen species can start this enzyme activated. Okay, it's called C-Jun N-terminal kinase 1, or junk 1, and it really is junk 1 because it is the bridge between metabolism and inflammation. So when you generate junk 1, you do bad things to your liver, which I will show you when we talk about fructose. So let's talk about fructose. So let's consume 120 calories in sucrose. A glass of orange juice. Everybody got it? So, two slices of white bread, a shot of Maker's Mark, a glass of orange juice. All the same 120 calories, but three different substrates. Let's see what happens to the fructose. So, number one, the glucose, remember, because sucrose is half glucose, half fructose. So 60 of the calories of the 120 are glucose. 12 are going to make it into the liver, 48 out here for the rest of the body. Okay, the same 20-80 split we had before with glucose. So far, so good. But all 60 calories of fructose are going to be metabolized by the liver. Why? Because only the liver can metabolize fructose. So what do we call it where when you take in a compound that's far into your body and only the liver can metabolize it and in the process generates various problems, what do we call that? We call that a poison. So let me show you how it's a poison. So let's watch the fructose. So the fructose comes in through this transporter now. Before it was GLUT2, now it's GLUT5. Okay? No insulin, remember, because fructose does not stimulate insulin. Fructose then gets metabolized by this guy over here called fructokinase to form something called fructose-1-phosphate. In the process, ATP has to give up 1-phosphate to ADP because the phosphate has to come from somewhere. So it comes from here. Now, before we had 24 calories that had to be phosphorylated. Now we have 72 calories that have to be phosphorylated. So we have three times the substrate, and there's the rub. It's a volume issue for right now. So we're going to lose a lot of phosphate, aren't we? So there's a scavenger enzyme in your liver called AMP deaminase 1 to rescue the phosphates off the rest of the ATP molecule. And it takes ADP down to AMP, adenosine monophosphate, down to IMP, inositol monophosphate, and finally to the waste product uric acid. Goes out in your urine, causes what disease? Gout, right, okay? It also causes another disease called hypertension. Let me show you how. Because uric acid, turns out, blocks the enzyme in your blood vessels called endothelial nitric oxide synthase. And that's the enzyme that makes this stuff called nitric oxide, NO. And that is your endogenous blood pressure lowerer. That keeps your blood pressure low. So when you can't make it, your blood pressure goes up. So this just shows that fructose consumption increases gout in adults. Okay, so this is a study that came out last year showing that fructose consumption increases the risk for gout, showing that uric acid is going up. And this is a study done by our pediatric renal fellow, Stephanie Wynn, just published in Journal of Pediatrics. Okay, it's not submitted anymore. It's long in press. Okay, showing that this is in the NHANES database in the adolescents, showing that sugared sweetened beverages, as it goes up, your uric acid goes up. And not only does your uric acid go up, but here's your sugared sweetened beverages, and here's your systolic blood pressure going up. And here's a study done by Dan Feig at the University of Texas San Antonio, where he took obese adolescents with hypertension, and he gave them the drug allopurinol. And allopurinol is the drug that you treat gout with to lower the uric acid. And look what happened to the blood pressure. Systolic, diastolic went down, showing that, in fact, uric acid is an important part of hypertension. We have a hypertension epidemic in this country. Here it is. It's the sugar. Okay, so far we have high blood pressure. Let's keep going. The fructose will get metabolized down to pyruvate. The pyruvate will enter the mitochondria just like before, throwing off a lot of citrate. Now here's a little trick that fructose does that glucose doesn't. Because these two can reform this stuff over here called fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, which can then reform with glyceraldehyde to form this guy over here called xylose 5-phosphate. And I'll get to xylose 5-phosphate in a moment. But I want to point out this asterisk. That's there to remind me to tell you that this is why the sports drink companies put high fructose corn syrup in the sports drinks. Because if you are glycogen depleted, in other words, if you just ran a marathon and you have no glycogen left in your liver because you burned it all, and you take in a sports drink with high fructose corn syrup, you can replete your glycogen faster than with glucose alone. That's true. So for elite athletes, a high fructose corn syrup containing sports drink actually makes sense. And so, indeed, sports drinks have high fructose corn syrup. The question is, who's drinking the sports drinks? The kids, right? Why are they drinking it? Because it's cool and it tastes good. Okay, so before we go on, I just want to now digress for a moment. 1967, University of Florida patents Gatorade. Everybody remember Gatorade? 1970, the Florida Gators win the NCAA championship in football. Gatorade makes a big splash. Anybody ever taste the original Gatorade? Tasted horrible. It tasted like something that you might find, coming out of you instead of going into you. 1992, Pepsi buys Gatorade. And they say, how are we going to market this swill? So what did they do? They added the high fructose corn syrup. So now who drinks it? Right, fat kids. Right? Not even skinny kids. Fat kids drink it. So there's a problem here. Okay, and we're going to show you how that works. Okay, so xylose 5-phosphate, just to show you. So here's, if you take a rat and you glycogen deplete them by making them run on an exercise wheel, okay, and then you refeed them with starch or with sucrose, the xylose 5-phosphate goes way up with the sucrose. Okay, so you get more xylose 5-phosphate through this pathway here. So why do we care about xylose 5-phosphate? Well, here's why. It stimulates this guy over here called PP2A, which then activates this transcription factor here, carbohydrate response element binding protein, which then activates what three enzymes? New fat making, right? The novolipogenesis. So here's the citrate, right? We got lots of that. Here we've got acyl-CoA, which is the way into fat, okay, which then gets packaged to the VLDL. And now you've got the dyslipidemia of obesity, of fructose consumption, which has been known for many years. So here's normal medical students, if you can call them normal. Taking in a glucose load, notice almost none of it ends up as fat. Taking in a fructose load, same number of calories, 30% of it ends up as fat. So when you consume fructose, you're not consuming a carbohydrate. you're consuming fat. So everybody talks about a high-fat diet. Well, a high-sugar diet is a high-fat diet. That's the point. That's exactly the point. This is a study where they gave acute administration of fructose, and you can see the triglycerides going up compared to the control. Okay, serum triglyceride right there. Here's normal medical students again. 6 days of high fructose feeding. Triglycerides doubled. De novo lipogenesis went up 5 times higher. And here's free fatty acids, which then caused insulin resistance, doubled. Okay, 6 days. So here's the dyslipidemia of fructose consumption. We're not done. Some of the fat won't make it out of the liver, just like with ethanol, and now you've got a lipid droplet, so now you've got this non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So this is work that we did in our clinic, okay, looking at sugar sweetened beverage consumption against the liver enzyme marker ALT, alanine aminotransferase, which tells you about fatty liver. And sure enough, here's sugar sweetened beverages against ALT, and you can see a nice linear relationship in Caucasians. African Americans, it's a different relationship, and that's a whole nother story all by itself. So there's the lipid droplet of alcohol, a non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. Some of it will come out as free fatty acids and populate the muscle. We'll also tell the insulin to go up higher. Remember that junk 1? So here's what junk 1 does. So the acyl-CoA and the fructose can all activate junk 1. And what junk 1 does is, remember when we use glucose, this IRS became tyrosine IRS1, and that was good. Remember that? Well, junk 1, what it does is it serine phosphorylates IRS1. And serine IRS1 is inactive. So now the insulin can't even do its job in the liver. So now you have liver insulin resistance as well. That's going to make the pancreas work that much harder, generating higher insulin levels, which raise your blood pressure even further, cause further fat making, cause more energy to go into your fat cell. There's your obesity. And finally, our research has shown that the higher the insulin goes, the less well your brain can see its leptin. And so there you've got continued consumption because your brain thinks it's starving. And it's been shown in many different ways that fructose consumption changes the way your brain recognizes energy, all in a negative fashion, so that you basically think you're starving. Your brain gets the signal that you're starving, even though your fat cells are generating a signal that says, hey, I'm full like all get out. Okay? This just shows you how it goes. So the high insulin generates the obesity because this is that, remember that first, the first law of thermodynamics, the biochemical force generating the energy storage as the primary phenomenon. Remember, if you're going to store it and you expect to burn it, then you're going to have to eat it. So here's the store it. Normally, that would make leptin, and the leptin should feed back and turn everything off. But it doesn't because the insulin gets in the way, and the high-fat diet gets in the way. Also, the hyperinsulinemia stops the leptin from acting on that nucleus accumbens, and so you get an increased reward signal. So that continues your appetite, continues more fructose, more carbohydrate, generating more insulin resistance, and you can see you generate a vicious cycle of consumption and disease and no stopping. So here we are, hypertension, inflammation, hepatic insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, dyslipidemia, muscle insulin resistance, obesity, and continued consumption. Looks like metabolic syndrome to me. So here are the phenomena associated with chronic ethanol exposure. Hematologic disorders, electrolyte abnormalities, hypertension, cardiac dilatation, cardiomyopathy, dyslipidemia, pancreatitis, malnutrition, obesity, hepatic dysfunction, that's alcoholic steatohepatitis, fetal alcohol syndrome, and addiction. Here's fructose, 8 out of 12. Why? Because they do the same thing. Because they're metabolized the same way. Because they are the same. They come from the same place, right? How do you make ethanol? Naturally. Right. You ferment sugar. Hasn't changed because it has all the same properties because it's basically taken care of by the liver in exactly the same way and for the same reason. Because sugar and ethanol are the same, every which way you turn. So here's our clinic intervention. This is what we do in our clinic. Okay, it's as simple as you can imagine. We write this on the back of a matchbook. Okay, I mean, it's just as simple as you can make it. We have 4 things we teach the kids to do and the parents. Get rid of every sugared liquid in the house, bar none. Only water and milk. Okay? There is no such thing as a good sugar beverage, period. Eat your carbohydrate with fiber. Why? Because fiber is good. Fiber is supposed to be an essential nutrient. And we can talk later, if you want, after the cameras turn off, as to why fiber is not an essential nutrient, because the government doesn't want it to be, because then they couldn't sell food abroad. Wait 20 minutes for second portions, okay, to get that satiety signal. And finally, buy your screen time minute for minute with physical activity. That's the hardest one to do. Okay? So if you play for half an hour, you can watch TV for half an hour. You want to watch TV for an hour, play for an hour. That one's a hard one. But anyway, we follow our patients every 3 months. So here's my question. Does it work? What do you think? Yeah, it works. Okay? So this is BMI Z-score, time from initial visit. It works. But we were interested in what made it work and what made it didn't work. So we did a multivariate linear regression analysis, right? The thing that made it not work, sugared beverage consumption. The more sugared beverages the patients drank at baseline, the less well the lifestyle intervention worked for all the reasons I just showed you. So why is exercise important in obesity? Because it burns calories? Come on. 20 minutes of jogging is one chocolate chip cookie. You can't do it. Are you joking me? So why is exercise important? Number one, it improves that skeletal muscle insulin sensitivity because your insulin actually works better at your muscle, okay, which then brings your insulin levels down, which is good for you. Number two, it's your endogenous stress reducer. It's the single thing that actually stress reduces. And if you stress reduce, what do you think your appetite does? Goes down. Because stress and obesity go hand in hand, right? For all sorts of reasons which are beyond the scope of this lecture today, but we can talk about in the question period if you want. And then finally, remember that de novo lipogenesis? Remember those three nasty enzymes? Okay. What if you burned the stuff off before you made the fat? That's what exercise does, because it makes that TCA cycle run faster, so you don't get the citrate leaving the mitochondria, so it doesn't get turned into fat, so it doesn't precipitate and cause all the problems you just saw. That's what they mean by a higher metabolism, yes. Okay? But it has nothing to do with burning of calories. That is the stupidest reason that I've ever heard of for exercise. You got to be joking me. Okay? You can't do it. I mean, one Big Mac, you know, and you've got to, you know, mountain bike for 10 hours. Are you joking? Okay, so why is fiber important in obesity? So this is my motto in clinic. When God made the poison, he packaged it with the antidote. Okay, because fructose is a poison. I think I've hopefully shown you that. Okay, but wherever there's fructose in nature, there's way more fiber. Do you ever see a piece of sugar cane? It's a stick. Right? You can't even chew the damn thing, right? You got to suck the stuff out like that, right? I mean, how many calories do you think you're going to get out of a piece of sugar cane? They actually did studies on the sugar plantations back in the early 1900s, okay? All of the workers were healthy and lived longer than the sugar executives who got the processed product. How about that? Wonder why, okay? So eat your carbohydrate with fiber. That's why we say that. That includes sugar. That's why fruit's okay. Because number one, it limits how much fructose you're going to take in. And number two, it gives you an essential nutrient, which you needed in the first place. And you get some micronutrients along with it so that you actually can, your liver works healthier. So here's what fiber does. Number one, it reduces the rate of intestinal carbohydrate absorption. Okay? Now, sometimes that's bad. I'll tell you when that's bad. Okay? You know when that's bad? That's bad when you're at a formal function. Because what happens if you reduce the rate of carbohydrate absorption in your gut? The bacteria get to it. Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, in life you've got two choices. It's either fat or fart. It increases the speed of transit of the intestinal contents to the ileum. Okay? And that raises this hormone over here called PYY, which goes to your brain and tells you the meal's over. That's your satiety signal. So when you add fiber to your diet, you actually get your satiety signal sooner because the food moves through faster. And then finally, it also inhibits the absorption of some free fatty acids all the way to the colon, and then those get chopped up into little itty-bitty fragments called short-chain fatty acids, and those actually suppress insulin as opposed to long-chain fatty acids, which stimulate insulin. So there are a whole bunch of reasons why fiber is good. Anybody ever heard of the Paleolithic diet? Okay, go home and read up on it on the internet. Okay, the Paleolithic diet. Basically, if you eat everything as it came out of the ground, raw, okay, with no cooking, okay, you would cure diabetes on a dime. Okay, it takes about a week. Okay, because you're getting that 100 to 300 grams of fiber I mentioned before. That's why. Because fiber is good for you. Okay, and the more, the better.
Type 2.
I stand corrected. Type 2. Okay. Okay. Now for some fun. Okay, that's the end of the biochemistry. Whew. How'd I do? I told you I'd get you through it. Okay, so now comes the fun part, okay? The racial innuendos and the, you know, all the political stuff, okay? The fructosification of America and, of course, the world. Ready? Another quiz. Can you name the 7 foodstuffs at McDonald's that don't have high fructose corn syrup or sucrose? No, mustard has it. Oh, come on, the big one. French fries. But they have salt, starch, and fat, so they're not so good either. Okay, what else? Hash browns, for the same reason, right? Salt, starch, and fat. Chicken McNuggets. I was shocked. No sucrose or high fructose corn syrup in chicken McNuggets. But as the circuit court judge in New York called them, they are still a McFrankenstein creation. Okay, but nonetheless, no sucrose. I was really shocked. Sausage. Oh, they're terrible. They're just disastrous. But, I mean, there's nothing good in them at all, but there's no fructose. Sausage, Diet Coke, coffee, if you don't add the sugar, and iced tea, if you don't add the sugar. By the way, the chicken McNuggets have, you know, we have a disclaimer, because no one eats the chicken McNuggets without the dipping sauce. And there's a whole bunch of high fructose corn syrup in the dipping sauce, right? So who's really drinking this? We talked about this before. Gatorade AM. So this is an attempt by Pepsi to capture market share on the juice market, right? Do you think there are any elite athletes who actually drink this stuff? Okay, this is for kids, right? This was my daughter when she was in second grade 2 years ago, Miriam Lustig. Okay, brought these 2 cartons of milk home for me and said, "Dad, you're not going to believe this." Okay, second grade. Okay, so here's the calories in Berkeley Farms 1% low-fat milk, 130 calories, 15 of them are sugars because it's lactose, right, which is okay. And here's Berkeley Farms 1% chocolate milk, 190 calories, 29 grams of sugar, all high fructose corn syrup. Okay, it's like a glass of milk plus a half a glass of orange juice. Okay? And that's what we're giving to our kids. And you know what the nutrition department at the SFUSD says? Well, we have to get our kids to drink milk somehow. Now, is that brilliant or what? I don't know. Now, what about WIC? Okay? So we talked about the 112 pounds of orange juice that the kid down in Salinas was drinking. What about WIC? So remember what we started with? We have an epidemic of obese 6-month-olds. Remember? So could this be the reason? So here's a can of formula. 43.2% corn syrup solids, 10.3% sugar. It's a baby milkshake. Soda, Coca-Cola, is 10.5% sucrose. Formula is 10.3% sucrose. And there's a huge literature that's now coming of age that shows that the earlier you expose kids to sweet, the more they're going to crave it later. Plus, there's a new literature that shows the more sugar the pregnant woman drinks or eats during the pregnancy, the more that gets across the placenta and actually causes what we call developmental programming, changing the kid's adiposity even before the kid is born and driving this whole epidemic even further. Here we got a can of Coke. Here we got a can of beer. So 150 calories each, no difference in terms of total calories. Percent carbohydrate, so 10.5% from sucrose here, except it's high fructose corn syrup, but who cares? Okay, 3.6% alcohol. Here's the breakdown, 75 fructose, 75 glucose for the Coke. Okay, 90 alcohol, 60 maltose for the beer. Remember, the first pass GI metabolism takes 10% of the alcohol off the table. So when you actually compute the number of calories hitting the liver, which, remember, was the big difference between glucose and fructose, remember, 72 versus 24, and started the whole thing into motion as terms of what happens that's bad, okay? Bottom line, no difference. So we have something called beer belly. Well, welcome to soda belly, because that's what America is suffering from. No ifs, ands, or buts. That's what it is. Okay? Now, you wouldn't think twice about not giving your kid a Budweiser, but you don't think twice about giving your kid a can of Coke. But they're the same. In the same dosing, for the same reason, through the same mechanism, fructose is ethanol without the buzz. Fructose is a carbohydrate. Yes, it is. But fructose is metabolized like a fat. And I've just shown you that 30% of any ingested fructose load ends up as fat. Okay, so when people talk about high-fat diets doing bad things, no, what they're really talking about is high-fructose diets. And that's what Ansel Keys was looking at. So the corollary to that is, in America at least, and around the world too, a low-fat diet isn't really a low-fat diet, because the fructose or sucrose doubles as fat. It's really a high-fat diet. That's why our diets don't work. And fructose, just like ethanol, for the same reason, through the same mechanism, and in the same dosing, is also a toxin. What can we do about it? Can we do anything about it? How about the FDA? You think they can do something about it? After all, aren't they supposed to regulate our food? Aren't they supposed to regulate what they can put in food? Weren't they supposed to regulate tobacco? Now they are, actually. So, you know, weird things. So I want to just show you what the tobacco company thinks of all this. This is actually from the UCSF Legacy Tobacco Documents Library that Stan Glantz runs right across the street. Okay, Stan's a good guy. Okay, likes Stan a lot. Okay, and he showed me this. He said, under the regulations governing food additives, so this came from an Altria or Philip Morris executive, it is required that additives be safe, defined as a reasonable certainty by competent scientists that no harm will result from the intended use of the additive. Now, does fructose meet that standard? Well, the FDA says that fructose, high fructose corn syrup, has what's known as GRAS, G-R-A-S status, generally regarded as safe. Now, where'd that come from? Nowhere. It came from the notion that, well, fructose is natural. It's in fruit. Must be okay. Yeah, well, tobacco's natural too, but it's not. Ethanol's natural, but it's not. Okay, a whole bunch of, you know, Jamaican ackee fruit's natural, but it's not either. It kills you. Okay. Keeping on going. A food shall be deemed to be adulterated if it bears or contains any poisonous or deleterious substance which may render it injurious to health. Fructose fits that description, right? But not with the prevention of chronic diseases, even though its own regulations explicitly postulate the connection between such products and such diseases. In other words, the FDA will only regulate acute toxins, not a chronic toxin. Fructose is a chronic toxin, right? Acute fructose exposure did nothing, remember? Because the brain doesn't metabolize fructose. The liver does. And the liver doesn't get sick after one fructose meal. It gets sick after 1,000 fructose meals. But that's how many we eat. So the FDA isn't touching this. The USDA isn't touching this. Because if the USDA touched this, what would that mean? That would mean an admission to the world that our food is a problem. So what do you think that would do? There are three things in this country that we can still sell overseas. Weapons, entertainment, and food. Cars? Computers? No, I don't think so. Can anybody think of anything else that another country wants of ours? What? Tobacco, right, tobacco. All right, you get the picture. All right? So the USDA doesn't want to know about this, okay, because this is bad news. Okay? And so who runs the food pyramid? The USDA. It's the fox in charge of the hen house. Okay, because their job is to sell food. And who's eating it? We are. So, in summary, fructose, and I don't care what the vehicle is, it's irrelevant. Sucrose or high fructose corn syrup, I don't care. Fructose consumption has increased in the past 30 years, coinciding with the obesity epidemic. A calorie is not a calorie. Okay? And the dietitians in this country are actually perpetrating this on us. Because the more you think a calorie is a calorie, the more you think, well, then if you ate less and exercised more, it would work. It doesn't. All of the studies show it doesn't work. Here's why it doesn't work. Because a calorie is not a calorie. Fructose is not glucose. We know a calorie is not a calorie because there are good fats and bad fats. There's good protein and bad protein. Okay, there's good carbohydrate and bad carbohydrate. And glucose is good carbohydrate. Glucose is the energy of life. Fructose, okay, is poison. You are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. And what you do with fructose is particularly egregious and dangerous. Hepatic fructose metabolism leads to all the manifestations of the metabolic syndrome. Hypertension through that uric acid pathway, de novo lipogenesis, dyslipidemia, hepatic steatosis through that DNL pathway, those three enzymes, the new fat-making pathway, inflammation through JNK1, hepatic insulin resistance because of the serine phosphorylation of IRS1, obesity because of the VLDL transport to the adipocyte, and leptin resistance promoting continuous consumption, basically starving your brain, making you think you need more. Fructose ingestion interferes with obesity intervention, as we showed in our clinic. The more soft drinks, the less well diet and exercise actually worked. Fructose is a chronic hepatotoxin for the same reason that alcohol is. The only difference is alcohol is metabolized by the brain, so you get alcohol effects. Fructose is not metabolized by the brain, so you don't get those effects, but everything else it does is the same. But the FDA can't and won't regulate it. It's up to us. I'm Robert Lustig, and I'm here to recruit you in the war against bad food. Okay? And this is what's bad. With that, I want to thank my colleagues at the UCSF Department of Pediatrics in our weight assessment for teen and child health clinic, UCSF Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, and also Department of Nutritional Sciences at UC Berkeley, in particular Dr. Jean-Marc Schwartz, who is a card-carrying fructose biochemist, PhD biochemist, who vetted all of these pathways that I've shown you today. And looked at this and said, oh my God, it is a toxin. He worked in this stuff for 15 years, and he didn't even realize it was a toxin until he saw it.
Americans, let's face it, we've been a spoiled country for a long time. You know what the number one health risk in America is? Obesity. Obesity. They say we're in the middle of an obesity epidemic. An epidemic like it's polio, like we'll be telling our grandkids about it one day. The great obesity epidemic of 2004. How'd you get through it, Grandpa? Oh, it was horrible, Johnny. There was cheesecake and pork chops everywhere. Nobody knows why we're getting fatter. Look at our lifestyles. I'll sit at a drive-thru. I'll sit there behind 15 other cars instead of getting up and making an 8-foot walk to the totally empty counter. Everything's mega meal, super size. Want biggie fries with that? Want a jumbo fry? Want to go large? Want a biggie fry? Want a 30 burgers for a nickel? You fat motherfucker, there's room in the bag. Take it. Want a 55-gallon drum of Coke with that? It's only 3 more cents.
So many points I could make under Richard Nixon. We had the war on drugs, which was a boon for the prison industry. At the same time, they were importing heroin and cocaine by the ton in military aircraft. We've got the war on terror. Simultaneously, they're training, arming, funding the terrorists, and then they're going to go out and fight them. And the war on obesity, encouraging people to believe what they need is low-fat food, which you then lace with sugar and makes people even more obese. Looked at from one perspective, this is insanity. Looked at from another perspective, it's a cracking business model. Now, there's one more point I'd like to add. I was reading about Richard Nixon, who happened to be in Dallas when Kennedy was murdered. And what was he doing there? He was a senior lawyer for Pepsi Cola. This and all previous episodes are available from our archive at unwelcomeguest.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Many thanks to everybody who suggested material, ideas for the show. Do keep it coming. You can email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Atomic Age. Humans and other living beings come last. Professor Norma Field. In all the memories recorded about the nuclear technologies and the disasters of our time, the fate of humans exposed to radiation comes last. That was the leading concept of a Fukushima Chernobyl anniversary talk by Norma Field. She hopes to rescue humans and other living things from oblivion and from the real harm inflicted upon them now and into the future. Some argue that Norma Field risked her academic standing as professor of East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago by not only teaching pre-modern Japanese poetry and prose and women's studies, but also by being public and vocal in her indictment of nuclear weapons and nuclear power. Born in Tokyo in 1947 to a Japanese mother and American serviceman father, she was in a unique position to understand each one of her cultures with curiosity as well as distance. Norma Field is the author of many books, among them In the Realm of a Dying Emperor, A Portrait of Japan at Century's End, and From My Grandmother's Bedside, Sketches of Post-War Tokyo. She spoke on March 20th, 2016 at DePaul University in Chicago. Here is Norma Field.
After Fukushima happened, and reflecting on my own relationship to the nuclear age, and when I was 10 years old, seeing the films released by the movement by Japanese citizens to buy back documentary footage from the United States, which had been confiscated at the end of the atomic bombs. And so citizens pulled together money to buy a foot at a time or an inch at a time of documentary tape. And I still, when I was 10, seeing these grainy black and white images of what happened after the bomb and seeing the very famous shot of a boy caught in profile and burnt in, melted down into the granite. And that image made me think, oh, someday I really have to teach about Japan, just to prevent war between the United States and Japan and to keep this from happening. That was one thought, you know, the omnipotent notion of a child that you can do something that will prevent war forever. And the other was, how could grown-ups go around every day when something so alarming had in fact happened? How could they think that getting dinner ready or going to their jobs was as important as making sure that never happened again? In any case, it wasn't very long after that that the Japanese government embarked on a campaign to help Japanese people get over their nuclear allergy. It was very patronizingly put. It was all about the new nuclear energy program, and therefore you had to make a distinction between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. And to be an advanced modern person in this country that was phenomenally, as we all know, arising from the ashes of war, reemerging, it was really important to accept nuclear energy. So I remember resisting and yet thinking about for a long time, and again after Fukushima, that the place where we can see nuclear weapons and nuclear energy coming together was at this moment in 1953, December, when President David Dwight Eisenhower, who is one of the top American military brass, who said, the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were unnecessary to end the war. Nevertheless, in the course of his presidency and with the intensification of the Cold War, began to increasingly worry about the strain, if you will believe it, on the American budget of military expenditures. So he is addressing the United Nations General Assembly to announce the Atoms for Peace program because, on the one hand, concern about the military expenditures had led him to espouse the use of nuclear weapons as a cheaper option. And the alarm that was causing among United States allies, he decided that he needed to come up with a different way of spinning the nuclear age, and that was Atoms for Peace. And as we know now, one of the first nations to be the beneficiary of this program was Japan. I think it was a senator from Illinois, not positive, who said, as a Christian nation, we owe no less to the Japanese, having dropped the atomic bombs on them, to give them the benefits of this technology. The program had kind of a setback with 1954, March 1st, the Castle Bravo shot, huge explosion test. It really sparked housewives. It was the housewives of one ward in Tokyo to start an anti-nuclear movement that gathered, I think, millions of petitions. This is a day before internet, just going door to door. And there was still that kind of sentiment available to being tapped in Japan and in the world. If you look at the Stockholm Declaration at that time, which also received enormous numbers of signatures. In any case, nuclear energy, despite this, I would say, mistiming, this shot and many, many others. Some of you may have heard about the Lucky Dragon, the tuna fishing boat that was caught in one of the U.S. tests, the Bikini test, and the captain came back, ended up dying shortly thereafter, but so much tuna had been offloaded already, radioactive tuna, and consumed all over Japan. That is a famous episode. What we don't know is how many other fishing vessels were caught in that wake and how much contamination took place all over Japan thanks to U.S. nuclear testing. And, it, of course, it's not just Japan. Pacific Island's a big place. For a long time, I've been thinking that this was the place where nuclear power and nuclear weapons really became linked. And only recently have I begun to think, you just have to go back to the very beginning, that this is a kind of strategic linkage which has been very powerful, which to this day continues to make it much, much easier for people to be opposed to nuclear weapons and not to nuclear power, especially in the age of global warming, thanks to the misleading notion that nuclear energy is a clean, green energy. I myself was not sufficiently aware until Fukushima about the distinction between internal and external exposure. And when you're told, oh, stop worrying about radiation, take a jet plane, dental x-ray, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I now like to minimize my dental x-rays too, but that we're talking about external sources of radiation, right? But if you're talking about internal exposure, that is to say you've ingested something, inhaled it, you had a cut on your skin in a highly dusty, contaminated place, then it's having a source inside your body that it's going to continue to emit, that it's going to be a source of ionizing radiation that is going to specifically, because these radionuclides settle in different organs, targeting different parts of your body. And you all know the scary numbers or the dizzying numbers about half-lives. I want to quickly go to the buildings of the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission. There was also one set up in Nagasaki. It is now replaced by the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, RERF, which is binational, staffed by Americans and Japanese scientists and technicians. It was started up in 1947, but in 1950, it started the long-term a study of Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors, which is still to this day considered the gold standard of health studies of survivors. I'm trying to sneer, indicate my sneering attitude towards this gold standard, since A, as the redoubtable Alice Stewart, does anyone know her? British pioneer epidemiologist. She's the one thanks to whom we no longer take beetle x-rays. She withstood a great deal of hostility and contempt and shaming to get there. She also did a long-term Hanford worker study. But in any case, as Alice Stewart pointed out many years ago, by 1950, right, the bombs were dropped in 45. By 1950, the most vulnerable members of the population would have died. You know, there were hard winters, the food scarcity. And so when you start studying in 1950, you're getting the hardiest part of the population, A, and B, the most upsetting part of, I think, of this study is it does not include, it was not looking for internal exposure. And for many, many years, people denied it. Now, I'll come back to that topic, but the ABCC was notorious. It was loathed and feared in the cities where they were established because they only measured, they only studied, they did not offer any treatment. In fact, the United States, not only was their press code censoring any information about the bombs, but once this was set in place, then there was, doctors were forbidden to study, scientists were forbidden to study anything about what had been dropped on their land, on their cities. People would be swept up, it is said, often from schools, and exposed in this way, measured, blood tested, so forth and so on. Grieving families would be asked to give up the bodies of their loved ones so that for autopsy in exchange, and this would not have been trivial in a poverty-stricken, defeated land, funeral expenses would be paid for. I think about this young woman, at least she's covered over, faced with this white guy in a coat who doesn't speak her language, and being measured, investigated, prodded, and knowing that there was nothing that was going to help her in terms of her own health. Now, what's important to realize is that there are indications that there were Japanese scientists who tried to extend research on their own in here, who were also curious about internal exposure and structurally could not pursue it. But it's also important to remember that the Japanese authorities were fully cooperative. In fact, they had begun their own study of the impacted well before surrender. So I think around August 10th, there were studies that were commencing on the bombed, A-bomb population in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this data handed over to the occupation authorities after surrender and occupation. So this notion of getting information but not informing the people who needed it the most, those who are impacted and those who care for them, goes very, very far back. This gentleman, Dr. Itsuzo Shigematsu, was a head of the, he died only a few years ago, of the RERF, the successor organization of the notorious ABCC. And he is the person who was tapped by the International Atomic Energy Agency, you know, the international agency that's supposed to provide us security through their watchfulness about nuclear materials and to promote the peaceful use of nuclear energy. He was tapped by the IAEA to do a Chernobyl study. 1990 began. The study came in 1991. He's a remarkable man. He found that there had been no health effects after the Chernobyl disaster. And instead, he found radiophobia. That is to say, it was psychological worry about the effects of exposure. But radiophobia has a very long life. I don't know that we'll ever succeed in killing it because it has been wonderfully recycled in Fukushima. The thing about this man, Dr. Shigematsu, is that he's used repeatedly for this kind of purpose. The fact that he was an expert from Hiroshima gave him the credentials to be tapped by the IAEA and to produce the, to make those implausible results credible. That is what I'm now beginning to understand. It wasn't his bent, though. I mean, because I've learned that only yesterday, though, that he found in Minamata mercury poisoning that there had been no health effects. In cadmium poisoning, no health effects. He seems to be particularly good at getting large, huge budgets, government budgets, to study terrible environmental episodes and to say with a straight face that there were no ill effects, that health had been okay, that the industrial age could continue as we had come to know and love it. Professor Yamashita, some of you may know him. Well, he's the radiation health risk advisor of Fukushima Prefecture. He's a second generation hibakusha from Nagasaki. His parents were there at the time of the bomb, which gives him tremendous credentials too, right? He took part in a massive Chernobyl study also, not that long after Dr. Shigematsu, and he did find pediatric thyroid cancer as one of the effects. It is really the only ill that is officially recognized by official sources, by which I mean Western, UN-related, U.S. sources, pediatric thyroid cancer, although if you read it, anything at all, you know that there are so many other effects that are associated. Cardiovascular problems, eye issues, chronic fatigue syndrome, so many diffuse and yet debilitating effects. So Dr. Yamashita was very useful, important for Chernobyl. But what happens when he's sent to Fukushima? He says, people who laugh a lot aren't affected by radiation. You know, laugh a lot and you'll be fine. You can stand exposure up to 100 millisievert a year. The International Commission for Radiological Protection, you have to learn these New Deal-like alphabet soup acronyms, but ICRP even says that for the regular public, 1 millisievert a year. And he says, up to 100, why not? So he has both massively hated and depended on in different ways, depended on by the authorities to keep anxiety under control, and depended on by the people who feel they have no option but to continue to live there, who don't want to be worried, who especially don't want to have to worry about the children who are dependent on their parents to look out for their health in a time when school lunches are about local growth, local consumption, right, which is good in general, maybe not so good in Fukushima, especially if you're not sure that the food that's gone into your child's school lunch has really been tested and whether that testing is to be relied on. And so it is very hard for parents who are worried to send children with their, even if they can secure permission from the school board, to send their own lunches. It's very hard because the parents and the child face ostracism. So that kind of thing. Dr. Yamashita has been very useful in those ways. This press conference took place in March 12th, a week ago. It is the newly formed Thyroid Cancer Family Association press conference announcing their launch. I thought that's fantastic because it's been so hard. Now, right now, the official count, according to the prefectural monitoring, the scans of child and youth thyroid cancer, is 166 cases of confirmed and suspected. So this is, in many cases, for thyroidectomy. I'm also learning from this that pediatric thyroid cancer is not what I had thought. Actually, pediatric thyroid cancer often will have metastasized to the lymph nodes. That has already happened. Pediatric thyroid cancer usually occurs at the rate of 1 to 2 in a million. and now, and 166 is an order of magnitude above that. And in the sublime way of Japanese officials, what they say every time there's an announcement is, it is difficult to believe that there is an association between the nuclear disaster and this incidence of thyroid cancer. In any case, what troubled me is two parents, there are only five families so far that have joined, appeared by Skype. Their faces were never shown, and their voices were altered. It was called a coming out, but what a coming out is that, where you have to hide your face and your voice altered, and that you as a victim cannot show yourself. You want to protect your child's privacy, to be sure, and their children have suffered already a great deal. It is not an easy thing to be told when you're a child that you have cancer. But at the same time, it's part of the government campaign to bring everybody back, to make sure that everything is cleaned up by the Tokyo Olympics. I would like to be able to mount some kind of opposition to the Tokyo Olympics, to 2020. It is not a good thing to support that. It is an excuse to siphon resources away that are desperately needed in Fukushima, but more than that, to augment the concealment distortion campaign, as Jeff Patterson, whom Dave is often rightly fond of quoting, scum, secrecy, cover-up, minimization, wherever the nuclear industry is composed. The Tokyo Olympics are a huge, huge occasion for scum. So with Fukushima people, right, it's so often the most vulnerable who have to contribute to their own further victimization, who can't afford to move out, who need continued employment. It is also those who have lost their means of livelihood who are doing the decontamination work in Fukushima and the decommissioning. It is Lucas's presentation made me realize again and again that only decades and decades and decades and decades of mitigation are foreseen for Fukushima, not anything that we might call decommissioning. And Japanese say enviously nowadays, in Chernobyl, they managed to put up the sarcophagus in 7 months. Well, we don't have anything contained in Fukushima. I met a friend who's a hydrologist, and he says, oh, you know, we hydrologists proposed underground barriers to keep that contaminated water from sloshing out, but our plans weren't accepted. I don't know what it is, but the construction industry seemed to get the better of the hydrologists. And maybe in a society that's fully capitalist, even at the time of this disaster, you just got so much competition among different industries that could realize a big profit that even those plans are seriously jeopardized all the time. And the other thing which keeps these parents with their faces covered and their voices altered is prejudice. I'm beginning to think discrimination might have been one of the most, I say this ironically, useful results of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. Discrimination from fellow Japanese, because you don't want your gene pool contaminated by the gene pool of anyone who suffered from the atomic bombs. I want to just call your attention to this. I find it really, really hard to find anything in English about what in Japanese is called the Chernobyl Act, which was established 5 years after, just as close to when the Soviet Union is being dissolved. But it's established under the Soviet Union, adopted subsequently in the independent nations of Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine. And this is something that Japanese invoke with great envy. This is Alexander Velkin, a liquidator, former liquidator, who has been invited numerous times to Japan. And this was in 2012, and he was saying, these are the standards prevailing in our country now. The reddest zone is the exclusion zone, and over 5 millisieverts a year is an area that you're not to live in. Between 1 and 5 millisieverts, you can ask for resettlement. There is a resettlement right to resettle, and there is financial compensation for that and various other ways to make that a reality. And finally, from 0.5 to 1 millisievert a year is a kind of privileged zone where the school lunches are especially cleaned, are shipped in from outside. There are various other provisions. Learning a bit more about the various versions of the Chernobyl Act, they're different in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, each of them, of course, having to do, and I would say declining, the services provided declining according to the finances of the state, and I'm sure very far from perfect. Now, as I said, the ICRP says for the general public, no more than 1 millisievert a year of exposure. The Japanese government said, we're going to decontaminate to 1 millisievert a year. Quickly found that that wasn't possible. You can't remediate forested land, and Fukushima is heavily, heavily wooded. I want to say, by the way, that it's wrong to just say Fukushima because, of course, the plume didn't stop at the prefectural boundaries. There is also elevated pediatric thyroid cancer in the northern regions of the metropolitan era. There are hot spots in Tokyo and beyond. But now, having the Japanese government having decided that they can't decontaminate to 1 millisievert a year, have just raised the standards. And so now they're saying up to 20 millisieverts a year, which, according to the ICRP, is what should be the annual exposure limit for occupational safety. And even that, most people will say in the business, we try to stay way below that. The lesson learned from Fukushima is you can't really clean up to levels that we have held up to now, so just change the standards. Now, things can get so distorted that you get terms like the right to return. Right, sounds good, the right to return home. Newspaper coverage says 170,000 people are still unable to return to their homes. We should feel sorry for them. What we have to feel truly sorry for is that they can't return to a safe home, but that they're being forced to return to a dangerous one. As Fukushima parents who have evacuated say now, we're faced with the choice of having our children submit to poverty or to exposure.
That was Professor Norma Field. She spoke at the event 5 years Fukushima and 30 years Chernobyl. The disaster continues. Her topic was the atomic age, how humans and other living beings come last. Norma Field has a PhD from Princeton and was professor of East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago until she retired in 2013. She was recorded by Dale Lehman on March 20th, 2016 at DePaul University, Chicago. Her original talk was much longer, and I urge you to look up Dale Lehman on www.radioforall for intriguing other pieces of history and moving observations about the human condition. Radio for All is spelled radio, numerical 4, all, or follow the link on tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening.
The Archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we'll have a chance to learn about former President Richard Nixon and the movies he watched. On his third night in office, January 22, 1969, Richard Nixon watched The Shoes of the Fisherman. from then until August in 1973, when he resigned the presidency, Nixon watched over 500 movies in the White House, at Camp David, and the other places he frequented. That's an average of 2.5 movies per week during the time that he was president. The book, Nixon at the Movies, A Book About Belief, by Boston Globe journalist Mark Feeney, examines the role that movies played in forming Nixon's character and career, and the role that Nixon in turn played in the development of American films. Ronald Reagan may have been the first movie star president, but Feeney argues that Nixon was the first true cinematic president. Nixon at the Movies is part biography, part history of American film, as well as a revelation of the mix between show business and politics of the 20th century. And it's a new approach to Richard Nixon's life and career. I spoke with Mark Feeney, author of Nixon at the Movies, from his office at the Boston Globe in January of 2005. He began by commenting on the effect that the 500-plus movies that Nixon watched during his presidency had on him, the presidency, and the nation.
Well, there are a couple times when his love of movies spilled over into, if not policy, then certainly into politics. The most famous example, which anyone who was around at the time will recall, is that it was revealed during the Cambodian invasion in 1970 that Nixon had screened three times before and during the invasion Patton, the Oscar-winning biopic about the old Blood and Guts, the World War II general. And there was much controversy at the time whether this was Nixon using Hollywood to fire himself up. I suspect it's just he really liked that sort of movie. And then there was another instance that's less well-remembered that when during the Manson trial, Nixon was asked what he thought was going on in the courtroom in L.A., and he cited a John Wayne movie he had just seen called Chisholm, which isn't that well remembered. But in it, John Wayne basically is John Wayne. He takes the law into his own hands. And there was widespread criticism of Nixon for citing this as an example of good jurisprudence. But more generally, it's not politics, I think, that there was this spillover, but it's more a reflection of his personality. He, as you noted, he was very unusual among politicians, and he was such a loner, someone so uncomfortable with people. And part of the beauty of going to the movies, as anyone who has done it knows, is that once the lights go down, you can be as alone as you want and still be stimulated, excited, transported.
Well, let's stay with the kinds of movies that attracted Nixon. They were movies of conflict. Patton was the war movie. The movie that you mentioned around the Manson trial was a movie of great conflict.
Yes. Well, he probably the genre he most liked was the Western, which, of course, is predicated on conflict and almost always violence. He was very fond of World War II movies. As a veteran of the war, he had a great interest in it, not just in his movie going, but his reading. In fact, his favorite piece of music was Richard Rodgers' Victory at Sea. But one of the fascinating things about looking at the list of films he saw while president is how extensive it is. He had favorites, certainly, but he just loved the movies, period. And so he saw a lot of musicals, comedies. It really was across the board. Probably the two yardsticks you can use would be, one, almost all the movies were American, not unusual for American film goers. And also, he tended to prefer older films to more contemporary films. And listeners may recall that during the Nixon presidency largely coincided with a period of great innovation and daring in Hollywood. what some people call the Silver Age, which, with the Robert Altman movies, Martin Scorsese getting started, the Godfather films, Chinatown. And he was sort of uncomfortable with what was going on in contemporary, that part of contemporary Hollywood.
Why do you think that was the source of his discomfort?
Oh, well, it's pretty obvious. I mean, you know, Nixon was a real straight arrow. In many ways, obviously, he broke a lot of rules politically. But part of what made the new Hollywood new was its much greater frankness in terms of language, in terms of violence, in terms of sexuality. And even more important than that, in its questioning of certain fundamental assumptions about American life and society. You know, Hollywood, throughout its history, has implicitly bought into and indeed propagated the American dream. But for this relatively short window, say between Bonnie and Clyde in 67 and Star Wars in 77, that 10-year period, there were a notable number of films, notable both in quantity and quality, that raised real questions about what was going on in America. There's one of the most notable, though it's, I think, an awful movie, this Easy Rider, and there's a moment in it where Jack Nicholson says, you know, this used to be a hell of a country, hell of a good country. And that, I think, expresses a fundamental attitude of Hollywood of that period, and that is not an attitude Richard Nixon shared. To him, this remained a hell of a good country, and at some level, I think he recognized that one of the reasons Jack Nicholson and, by extension, the New Hollywood could raise that question is because of who was in the White House at that time, meaning himself.
Yet he was influenced by movies throughout his presidential career.
I don't know if I would say influenced. I mean, there were certainly many connections. He was a moviegoer from a very young age, as were most people of his generation. You know, the movies for people in the 30s and 40s were what television has been for people since the 60s on. And he served on the House Un-American Activities Committee at the time of the famous Hollywood 10 hearings. A number of his major backers, financial backers, were Hollywood executives such as Daryl Zanuck or Jack Warner of Warner Brothers. His wife, Pat, worked her way through USC as a film extra, movie extra, at Paramount. So there were many connections to his life and career. I don't know if you'd say political connections, though.
Well, in 1950, when he ran against Helen Gahagan Douglas, a person who had a history in the movies, he took some glee in beating her to become the United States Senator from California.
Yes, though I think that had as much to do with her politics and her glamorousness as it did with her Hollywood history, which was, in fact, twofold. Not only had she herself been a film actress in the early 30s, but as some listeners may recall, the Douglas in the Helen Gahagan Douglas was Melvin Douglas, the Academy Award-winning actor, who, oddly enough, would later go on to play the lead in the stage version of Gore Vidal's play The Best Man, in which the villain is very clearly modeled on Richard Nixon. So there are all these funny connections.
In the time from when Nixon left the Navy in 1945, in the next 7 years to when he became vice president, what effect did your review show that movies had on him during that time?
Twofold, I suppose. Then, as now, Hollywood was largely quite liberal, but there were conservative elements there, and a number of well-known Hollywood types supported him in 1946 when he ran against Jerry Voorhees. Barbara Stanwyck, for example, and her then-husband Robert Taylor. More important was his having a place on the House Un-American Activities Committee when it held its now notorious hearings on the effect of communism in Hollywood. And what's interesting is that Nixon already was demonstrating his shrewdness in that he showed up for the first day when among the witnesses was Jack Warner of Warner Brothers Pictures, and he basically lobbed him a few softballs, which Warner gratefully hit back over the fence. And then Nixon disappeared. He knew that this would be a circus, and he also knew that even though his own district didn't include Hollywood, still he was the only Californian on the committee, and it was best for him to lie low.
His district was Whittier, which is about 30 miles from Hollywood.
Yes, yes.
And for people in that time and that era, of which I was a boy during those periods, and I remember many discussions about the Hollywood 10 and the House Un-American Activities Committee investigation, Nixon appeared to have a forceful role in fomenting and bringing those hearings to Hollywood. Did you find that to be true in your research?
Nixon was very much a junior member of the committee, and there had long been going on difficulties between the committee and Hollywood. My sense, and my researches were much more focused on Nixon as president, but my sense is that if anything, Nixon sort of would have preferred that that be backpedaled. People like Jack Warner were very anti-communist, but even more than that, they were very pro-profits. And the last thing they wanted was to have any kind of cloud over Hollywood. And certainly once they appeared before the committee, they were very much, in favor of it and against these, this red influence in Hollywood. But that's not what they would have wanted. And I think Nixon basically was looking out for a leading industry near his district. And if you go back and look at the transcripts, he has almost nothing to say. It's people like J. Parnell Thomas, who was the chairman, who really laid into the Hollywood 10.
Let's talk about Nixon socially and how he moved politically to see if that gives some indication into the movies that he chose or into other areas. You say that socially there was nothing instinctive about Nixon. And when in doubt, he turned to what he was most comfortable with, football and Robert's Rules of Order.
Right, right. He didn't have an intuitive understanding of people. Someone like Bill Clinton, or if you're a Republican, George W. Bush, they walked into a room full of people and they didn't know anyone, they'd manage fine. Richard Nixon would not have managed fine. One of the more amusing anecdotes from the 68 campaign is during their New Hampshire primary, Nixon has to go from one place to another, and he wants someone to talk to. So whom do they choose out of the press corps but Hunter S. Thompson? Why? Because Thompson is the biggest football fan among the reporters. And in fact, Nixon and Thompson have this perfectly fine conversation for 15 or 20 minutes because they have football to talk about. And I think part of the reason that Nixon throughout his life liked the movies so much, and particularly as president, was that this is it's a social setting. I mean, so far as I know, he never went by himself. In fact, one time he even dug up Haldeman's secretary, H.R. Haldeman, his chief of staff, Haldeman's secretary, to go with him at Camp David. But once the lights go down, it's a way of being with people but not having to deal with them, which I think from Richard Nixon's point of view is ideal. Let me tell you what to me is an extraordinary anecdote, which Gerald Ford relates in his memoirs. When President Ford became President Ford and moved into the White House, he was struck by the fact that whenever he would greet a member of the White House staff, an usher or a maid, what have you, that person, without fail, would not acknowledge him. It was very strange. So finally, he made inquiries, and he was told that President Nixon had left instructions that whenever he or Mrs. Nixon greeted someone, they were not to respond. To me, this is emblematic of Richard Nixon. He observes the social niceties. He, doesn't act like some sort of rude aristocrat who ignores those around him. He will acknowledge them, but then he wants to remain invisible to them. He doesn't want them to respond, which then would initiate some kind of further interaction. It's quite extraordinary, don't you think?
I'd like to take a moment and say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Boston Globe journalist Mark Feeney about his book, Nixon at the Movies, It tells the story of Richard Nixon and Richard Nixon's relationship to the movies. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Mark Feeney, the role that Nixon had in the development of the American film, can you discuss that with us?
Well, I don't know so much that I'd say he had a role in the development, but it does seem to me that this period that coincides with his presidency, which in many ways is a silver age for Hollywood, with these extraordinary films, and many of the most extraordinary, extraordinarily dark, they are in a way part of a dialogue, an implicit dialogue between the man in the White House and Hollywood, which is trying to understand America, trying to get a better handle on it. You know, if you look, Chinatown, with this study of conspiracy and evil in high places, I don't think it would have been made without Watergate. Watergate suffuses, the shadow of Watergate covers Godfather II. If you go back to what's generally considered Hollywood's golden age, the studio era of the 30s and 40s, it seems to me one can argue that those films very much reflect the character and personality of the inhabitant of the White House then, Franklin Roosevelt, the sunniness, the confidence, the sense of commonality. Conversely, it seems to me that the Silver Age, however inadvertently, reflects Richard Nixon, the paranoia, the skepticism, the sense of distrust. We can never know how Hollywood would have, what they would have done had Hubert Humphrey been elected president in 1968. But there does seem to be a very striking resonance between a number of the greatest films of this period and Richard Nixon's own character and personality.
Can you link that to specific films for us?
Oh, sure, sure. The Conversation, for example, which is the film Francis Ford Coppola made between the two Godfather films. It's all about eavesdropping and conspiracy, surveillance, very much made in the shadow of Watergate. I mentioned earlier this Godfather II. Those who've seen it may recall that a key scene in it consists of Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, going before a Senate crime committee. Now, ostensibly, that's modeled on the Kefauver crime hearings of the early 50s. But remember, this movie came out roughly 18 months after the Watergate hearings had been on television, which, as anyone our age will remember, was just perhaps an unparalleled event in television history, the impact of them, the way they just filled the networks. Anyone seeing that film at that time, that's what they're thinking about. And Diane Keaton, as Michael Corleone's wife, Al Pacino's wife, sitting behind his shoulder, it's just like Maureen Dean sitting behind John Dean during the Watergate hearings. John Dean, of course, the White House counsel who blew the whistle on Watergate. So those would be two examples. More intriguingly, perhaps, in movies that aren't overtly political, you find Nixon references or Nixon allusions. Jaws, which seems like, you know, classic summer entertainment. But if you think about it, the basic plot is about a conspiracy, a cover-up. The business figures in the resort community want to cover up how serious the shark attacks are because they don't want to affect the tourism. And in fact, at one point in the movie, there is a shark, not the shark of the jaws of the title, but another shark is hanging from a hook, and a passerby is heard to remark, "Gee, that's a deep throat." You could make a study, if you wanted, of how many of these Nixon references or throwaway lines there are. Another example, quite minor but very amusing, is Art Carney won an Academy Award for Harry and Tonto, Best Actor for Harry and Tonto, a movie about an old man and his cat. And yet at one point, you'd think, well, what does that have to do with Watergate or Nixon? At one point, he buys a newspaper from a news dealer, and he cheerily announces, "So who's the vice president today?" You know, Watergate, it was everywhere. It was this pervasive atmosphere, and it spilled over into Hollywood.
Well, Mark Feeney, what drew you to write this book, to focus your efforts on Nixon at the movies?
Well, it was very specific, in fact. I'd long been extremely interested in Nixon and also a pretty serious filmgoer. And the day after Nixon died, I received a phone call from a friend of mine who's a film writer, and he said, we're talking about Nixon, and I said to him, you know, you should write something about Nixon in movies, because there are, as we mentioned earlier, some of these connections between his life and Hollywood. And he said, no, you should. And I thought, well, gee, that's interesting. Maybe I will. But I just thought it would be some sort of essay. And then at this time, shortly after Nixon died, H.R. Haldeman, who'd been his chief of staff, his right-hand man, published his diaries. And on the CD-ROM version of the diaries is included the president's daily schedule. And I was reading them on CD-ROM, which perhaps will suggest how serious I am about Richard Nixon. And again, the presidential schedule would, after dinner, would list movie. And I thought, wow, this guy saw an awful lot of movies. And in fact, if you go to the National Archives, and as an aside, I will note, as many of your readers are perhaps not aware, the Nixon presidential papers are not in the Nixon Presidential Library, but in fact the National Archives retains them because Congress did not trust Nixon to have his own papers after he resigned from office. So if you go to the National Archives, you can look up the list that the Secret Service kept. It's called the Presidential Daily Diary, and find out the list of films that he saw while president. And it's I just see it as a fascinating window onto this man's personality. I dare say if someone kept a list of the films that any of us watches over the course of years, it'd be a very interesting window onto who we are. But to have this window on a president is very interesting. And above and beyond that, a president who seems so alien to all that we associate with Hollywood. It's glamour, it's excitement, it's sense of fun and entertainment. We think of Richard Nixon as being so dour and glum and driven, and he certainly was those things, but this is another side of him.
Comparing Nixon to the other presidents, he watched over 500 movies in the period of time that he was in office of about 6 years. How about the other presidents? What's your observation or your review of the number of movies that they watch?
Well, the record holder, is, in fact, isn't Nixon, but it's Jimmy Carter. But I don't know this, but I believe the reason for that is because Carter had a young daughter, and I assume that she saw a lot of films, and of course he would watch them with her, Amy Carter. But among other presidents, the biggest movie fan was, of course, Ronald Reagan, for whom it was in some ways a busman's holiday, I guess. Bringing back to his previous career. Both Kennedy and Johnson, they would get restless. And if that didn't interest them, well, in fact, Kennedy would walk out, whereas Johnson would sort of wander in and out in that perpetual motion way of his. Eisenhower loved Westerns, and that was pretty much it. And then I know Clinton liked the movies a lot, but I don't. Basically, once I got to Nixon, that became my focus. It was more his predecessors. And the one other thing I would add, it was Franklin Roosevelt, who was a big movie fan, who had the theater put into the White House, the movie theater.
You report that Nixon never once fell asleep at a movie that he was watching.
That's what Paul Fisher, the Navy yeoman who is the White House projectionist, told me, yes. So far as I know, he did once walk out of a movie. According to Haldeman, it was West Side Story, and Haldeman reports that as he was leaving, Nixon muttered that it was propaganda. Now, propaganda for what? I don't know. Puerto Ricans? The welfare state? I don't know. But that, so far as I—and Richard Nixon loved musicals, believe it or not, so it makes it all the more surprising. But he did walk out of West Side Story.
And he loved the conflict that was portrayed in real life and in the movies, which
oh,
is
sure.
clear in West Side Story.
That's certainly true. That's certainly true. But it's interesting. I mean, the conflict that he liked tended to be he liked it, how to put this, you know, organized to a higher purpose. Most obviously in warfare or in politics, and maybe seeing characters that he might have dismissed as young punks, you know, with their switchblades and fistfights. Maybe he didn't go for that. Who can say?
Mark Feeney, author of Nixon at the Movies, a book about belief. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, I would say the most interesting book I have read of late is by David Thompson, and it's called The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. And some of your listeners may know of Thompson's work through his Biographical Dictionary of Film. I think he's without question our best writer on film these days, and he looks at Hollywood really not just in terms of the movies, but the business behind the movies, the cultural impact of the movies. It's just a thrilling way of looking at Hollywood, and in fact, what he's writing in some ways is a kind of shadow history of 20th century culture. It's I think any of your listeners who are interested in the movies or in American culture will really enjoy it a lot.
Mark Feeney, author of Nixon at the Movies, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
Barry, thank you.
Mark Feeney is the author of Nixon at the Movies, a book about belief. The book that Mark Feeney recommends is a book about American cinema called The Whole Equation by David Thompson. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482.